This is the October 12th, 2016 SEC meeting.
I can't start until I actually get official.
If we're all set up and they can hear us down south, then we're good.
And they can see us, we just can't see them, so they can actively participate.
How will they, if they want to speak, how will we know?
They'll have to identify themselves.
Okay.
Old school.
Or the chair can ask if there's any comments.
I will do that.
Yeah, just defer.
Okay, then we will open this meeting. This is the meeting of the Nevada State Environmental Commission. It's Wednesday, October 12th, 2016. It's about 7-8 minutes after 10. The meeting location for the commission itself physically is the Bryan Building located at 901 South Stewart Street, second floor, Town Hall Conference Room. We are video conferencing this meeting to Las Vegas at the Nevada Division Environmental Protection Office located on 2030 East Flamingo Road, Suite 230. Okay, before I start this meeting, really get into the agenda, I'll make a couple comments. I've been on this commission for a long time, over a decade. And I think, I just want to point out something that occurred to me, that this is one of the strongest commissions that I have set on. I mean, I'm talking about the State Environmental Commission. The membership of this commission is extraordinary. There's just no question about it. And I'm not going to go into any detail about some past commissions, but take my word for it. There are some really good people in this commission. And I think the state of Nevada can be proud. I'm sure it's certainly honored to be able to sit with you guys, guys and gals. And also, I want to just comment also that we have a really great staff. I'm a little concerned about Dave Demme, but we'll bring him up. Okay, with that, we'll start. Calling me to order, Val, I'll give it to you for a roll call and make sure we have a forum.
Thank you, Chairman Gantz. Good morning, members of the commission. Chairman Gantz?
Present.
Vice Chair, Mr. Tom Porta?
Here.
Mr. Jim Barbie?
Here.
Mr. Jason King?
Here.
Ms. Catherine Landry?
Here.
Mr. Bob, oh, we don't have Bob Roper anymore. We have Joe Freeland, and he is not here. Mr. Rich Perry?
Here.
Mr. Kerry Richardson?
Here.
Mr. Mark Turner?
Here.
Mr. Tony Wadsley?
Here.
And counsel for the AG's office today is Ms. Hina Russell.
Here.
Okay, so we have a quorum.
We do have a quorum.
Okay, I'm going to make that official on the record. The meeting has been properly noticed and posted. Okay, and are there any changes to the agenda? Any deletions, additions, any changes in order?
Not that we're aware of at this point, unless the commission chooses to do so.
Okay, and I want to point out also that I think we have Catherine's full attention today. She recently retired. And she's been so busy, so we're glad that you're retired and now you give full focus to this.
Like I didn't give you full focus.
Thank you, Catherine. Okay, that's item one. Item two is public comment. If there's any members from the public that would like to speak, this is your first opportunity. I want to point out that we will not consider taking any action on any item that's not on the agenda. If it hasn't been properly. And I will limit any speaking to 10 minutes or less. So is anybody in this audience here in Carson City that has anything they would like to say at this point? Okay, seeing none, how about in Las Vegas? Anybody in Las Vegas? Okay, hearing none, we will assume that everybody's talked that want to talk, and we'll go on to item number three, which is the approval of the February 10th, 2016.
Excuse us, we have someone in Las Vegas who wants to talk.
Okay, we can't see, so I apologize. Certainly, go right ahead.
No, you're fine.
Who is, please state your name, address, affiliation for the record, please.
Yes, my name is David Sharp. My address is 3128 East University Avenue, Las Vegas, 89121. My profession is, I'm a business development manager, regional sales manager for Verde, CNG, LNG, and electric vehicle charging stations. I've been in sustainability as a profession and as a professional advocate since 2000. community. And I've been in electric vehicle charging and alternate fuels for the last 4 years. My comment that I'd like to add today regarding two agenda items. One is number 11, which is I wholeheartedly support the L098-16. As a provider of community companies, I'm sure the possibilities all over the country will be participating in electrifying and alternate fuel that is also regarding item number 12, the 2007.
Gentlemen, speaking from Las Vegas, we can't see you. I'm not sure you're at the right meeting, I guess is what I'm asking. The pertinence of your comments, I'm trying to figure out how it relates to what we're doing. So it's a matter of record, it's recorded, we have your name, and it'll be in our record if in fact you really are at the right meeting for those comments. So I appreciate that. Is there anybody else in Las Vegas that would like to comment?
We're good down here. Thank you, sir.
Okay, thank you. Okay, now we'll move on to item number 3, approval of the February 10th, 2016 meeting minutes. This is for possible action. Are there any comments, changes, additions, deletions from commission members? Look over these minutes.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Just one small correction on page 5 of the minutes. The first full paragraph, it talks about how Anaconda Yarrington Copper Mine site was operated in the 1050s. I think that's supposed to be the 1950s.
Mr. King, I'm impressed. Okay. Any other comments, changes? Hearing none, we need a motion.
Mr. Chair, I would move to approve the minutes as corrected.
I'll second that.
It's been moved and seconded to approve the minutes. Any discussion on the motion? Not all those signified by aye, but you approve.
Aye.
Opposed, nay? carries. Thank you. Okay. So we start with item four, which is a discussion and adoption of a 36-month grant from NAC 486.180. And this is coming from the city of North Las Vegas. I'm assuming the city has a rep to present this to us, and I imagine it's in Las Vegas. Is that correct?
Yeah, I'm here. This is Mike Cudgins with City of North Las Vegas, 2250 Las Vegas Boulevard, 200 North Las Vegas, Nevada, 89030. The primary reason for this request would be financial hardship. I'm sure you guys are all well aware, the financial status of the city has been well documented in the press. Unfortunately, we were one of the hardest hit with the economic collapse here recently, and we're still kind of in recovery mode. That being said, we are moving in the right direction, and we look for this variance to kind of assist us along that path. Secondary to that is also fuel availability. The city does not own or operate any of our own tanks, so we are at the mercy of commercial available fuels, which biodiesel is not available in the city of North Las Vegas. I think everything else is kind of outlined in the letter. If you have any questions, I'd be more than happy to answer.
Okay. Are there any questions from commission members? I have a question, Mr. Hutchins. I noticed that the Clark County letter that supports your request is dated December 15th, 2015, almost a year ago. To the best of your knowledge, this letter still stand for what you're asking?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
Okay. I'm wondering if there's anybody from staff, state staff, that can let us know where the state is on this request.
Morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the commission. My name is Sig Yownrice. I'm with the Bureau of Air Quality Planning with NDEP. NDEP has no objection to this petition by the city of North Las Vegas, but there are a few remarks I'd like to make for the record. The city of North Las Vegas has had a bit of a spotty record with regard to complying with this provision, NAC 486A. And the reason they've had a spotty record is just as the gentleman said, they have never invested in the fueling infrastructure that would allow them to comply. So we recognize it's expensive to put in alternative fuels, fueling infrastructure, but should this petition be granted, we would expect that the city of North Las Vegas would make a firm plan for how to get back into compliance. And should that plan include the construction of alternative fueling infrastructure, that they get it on their budget for future years, and that they keep the division apprised of any developments as they move forward towards compliance. And that concludes my remarks.
Does the state have any problem with the time period? I mean, the length of this variance, it's 3 years.
Yeah, it is a long period of time, but considering how long it takes to get capital improvement projects budgeted for and constructed, that does not seem unreasonable.
So are you assuming that North Las Vegas will be doing this during this three-year period?
Yes, we do.
Do you know of any plans they have to do this during the three-year period?
None yet, other than they've just told us they're working on it. But we have no firm plans as yet.
Jason?
Say a couple things. Is this their first variance? And then secondly, he qualified his answer by saying that they don't have facilities in North Las Vegas. Are there other places besides North Las Vegas where they can get fuel from?
It depends. Generally, the way fleets are able to comply is to develop their own fueling infrastructure. So what City of North Las Vegas has done in the past is they've gone to the fueling infrastructure of other city and county agencies, used their fueling infrastructure, and they had a way of making sure that the bill went to the right fleet. As far as private fueling stations, there are very few that carry biodiesel in Las Vegas. There are some, yes. But, you know, then it becomes a matter of, do you want to send a vehicle, you know, halfway across the city? Does that comport with the idea of, you know, improving air quality from a fleet?
Thank you. And the first question, is this their first variance?
I believe this is their first variance, but we have had a number of discussions over the years with them on compliance. Like I said, it's been spotty.
Thanks.
Tom?
I'm going to wait until we hear agenda item 8.
Okay.
Because I think I'd be speaking out of line, because I want to know how that relates to these variances. But I'll wait until we get to that.
Okay.
And I saw that also when I read the agenda. Are these in the right sequence here?
Well, certainly if agenda item 8 is approved, it will change the thinking of the fleets on how they'll be able to comply. And it's possible they may not have to build fueling infrastructure, but they will still have to come up with a plan to show us how they're going to comply. And, you know, is 3 years an appropriate time frame, I guess, would be the question then. They could probably comply a lot sooner than 3 years if they don't build fueling infrastructure.
Are you suggesting to this commission that we should consider a time frame other than 3 years?
You know, at this point, I would not urge that. I would still go with 3 years because they, for their diesel vehicles, they likely would have to build some fueling infrastructure. Yeah, I don't think they'll be able to get away from that.
I had the same question, I think, that Tom and you had, and that really is if RO 8916, which is a change to NAC 486A, were to pass today, how does this affect this, since there's a change in reformulated gasoline? And I guess, you know, to me, it does have to be, we have to ask that question now, because if we pass this, and it could be that we want to go back and say, let's, you know, one option here is to defer this to the next meeting if this is passed, and then we say, go back, and with these new regulations, where does this fit now? I almost feel like we got the cart before the horse as far as the sequence goes on this. So,
I was just asking our guy whether or not we should defer action on this particular item until we address the other item later in the agenda and then come back on this. Is that something you guys want to do? Yeah. Rich, I know that's kind of where you're going.
I almost feel like we would need to do that either today. I'm not so sure if we can even do it today. Maybe it shouldn't be the next meeting. Just defer this to the next meeting. That would give North Las Vegas time to read if these are passed today and respond and see if that's going to be a change in what's proposed here. Because a lot of the issue may go away, is what I'm...
That's true, yes.
Okay.
Mr. Hudgens, before you have any comments right now, we are considering holding action on this item until we take action, if we are going to take action on another item. Do you have any problems with that, or do you want to address the state's comments?
No, we're fine with that. That makes sense to me.
Okay. Given the comments of the commission, I think we need a motion to hold this item. We can hold it either until we take action on another one or maybe to another meeting. Will this put North Las Vegas in any particular problem if we shouldn't take action today? We're meeting again in November, correct, Val?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman, I think we could just exercise enforcement discretion and hold off. But we still would like to hear North Las Vegas and any plans they might have in their interim period, yes.
Okay. So what's the pleasure of the commission?
Just if I could ask a question, then what if we approve this for 3 months?
Just for 3 months.
And then come back to it at the next meeting, or It's probably easier to just defer this to the next meeting.
I think it's
okay, okay.
As long as we're not putting North Las Vegas in any kind of a precarious position by waiting 30 days.
Yeah.
Mr. Hutchins, do you see a problem with waiting 30 days?
No, that's acceptable.
Okay.
But move to postpone to the next meeting and place on the next meeting's agenda.
Do I hear a second to the motion?
Second.
Made and seconded that we postpone action on this, bring this item back on the November meeting, give a little time to look at this, and also I'm cognizant of your comments. Maybe the state, I mean, maybe North Las Vegas can give you a little more information on where they might go based on what we might do here today.
Yes, that would be appreciated.
Okay, Mr. Hutchins, are you okay with that?
Yes, sir.
Okay, sounds good. So the motion been made and seconded. Is there any comments on the motion? Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by aye.
Aye.
Opposed? None. Motion carried. Thank you. Okay, we'll now go on to item number 5. And that is LCB file number RO91-16, Bureau of Water Management.
Bureau of Waste Management.
Maybe if I put my glasses on, I can read.
Good morning. I am Jim Trent, supervisor of the Program Development Branch of the Bureau of Waste Management. With petition R019-16, the Bureau is proposing to make minor but necessary corrections, clarifications, and updates to the state hazardous waste regulations. No negative economic impact, no increased regulatory burden, and no change in hazardous waste management practices are expected from these proposed revisions. A workshop to solicit comment on the regulations was held in Carson City with a video link to NDEP Las Vegas on September 21, 2016. The workshop notice was published in 3 newspapers, distributed via email and regular mail to all parties on the hazardous waste mailing list, and posted at several locations around the state. It was also available for review and comment on the NDEP webpage. 20 members of the public attended the workshop. There were 2 questions asked. I'll discuss them a little later, right before I call for any questions you may have. Minutes, including questions and answers from the workshop, were posted on the NDEP webpage. As you may know, in order to remain consistent with federal regulations and authorized to enforce them in lieu of the US EPA, Nevada is required to periodically update its state hazardous waste regulations in response to changes made at the federal level. NDEP has adopted federal waste regulations, federal hazardous waste regulations, through 2008. Once lawsuits involving federal regulations passed in 2009 through 2015 are resolved, BWM will move forward with a petition to update our adoption by reference of federal regulations. In the meantime, EPA Region 9 conducted a comprehensive review of Nevada's hazardous waste regulations from 1985 through 2015. With this petition, we are addressing federal concerns related to regulations approved through July 1, 2008, and also proposing 2 minor state-initiated revisions. Please note that although there are some 37 sections to the petition, the same few changes are being made in multiple locations. Again, we are not revising our adoption by reference date of federal regulations. We are not adopting new regulations. The proposed changes should have no economic impact, no increased regulatory burden, and there should be no change to hazardous waste management practices if these revisions are approved. I've described their impacts or lack thereof. Now let me briefly discuss the proposed changes. First, the state initiated changes in sections 2, 3, 29, and 31 through 37, references to the specific adoption by reference date, July 1, 2008, better be deleted from provisions of state regulations that refer to individual federal regulations. This will result in a single adoption by reference date in our state hazardous waste regulations at NAC 444-8632. Deleting these unnecessary date references will make the regulations consistent throughout the various portions and make adoption by reference petitions simpler and more concise by reducing the number of regulations that must be updated. In the second state-initiated change, sections 1, 4 through 13, 15, 16, 19 through 28, and 30, the phrase, as adopted by reference in NAC 444-8632, is inserted into additional portions of the state regulations that also reference individual federal regulations. When revised, these regulations will be in the same format and consistent with the group of regulations I just discussed previously. The EPA requested changes in sections 5, 8, 9, 13, and 17, correct minor omissions noted by EPA Region 9 in their comprehensive review by adding a missing subpart G to the existing Part 124 citation, clarifying that subparts H, I, and J of Part 270 relate to RCRA permits, and update the price for copies of various CFR volumes should anyone wish to order one by mail. And finally, in Section 18, references to Section 267.150, an obsolete federal regulation, is deleted in two spots where it occurs, and the wording for financial assurance instruments which cover facilities in more than one state are clarified, again to address concerns noted by EPA in their review. To summarize, we are not revising our adoption by reference date. We're not adopting new regs. The proposed changes, while necessary to update our state regulations, should have no negative economic impact, and there should be no changes to the federal hazardous waste management practices. Two questions were asked by the public. The first one, do these revisions make significant changes in hazardous waste management in Nevada? Will they cost more money? The answer is no. And the second question had to do with the editing style, and the question was, if CFR 267.150 is to be deleted, why is it not in brackets with a line through it? And the answer is simply because it's being added to a list of items which are to be deleted. So it has to be added to the deletion list to make the deletion. With that, I would ask if you have any additional questions, I'd be glad to try and answer them.
Questions from the commission?
Mr. Chairman? I'm sorry. Go ahead. I keep interrupting you. I have no substantive comment on the changes. It's really kind of out of curiosity. So you talk about in Section 17, you actually put the new costs of these volumes into your regs.
We're required by the statute.
Thank you.
And that's, for the record, that's a question in my 20 years. It comes up about every 3 years when I do this. Why on earth are you required to do that? But the statute requires that the cost of that be known. I think it's predicated in the time long ago when people would order by mail before these things could be gotten free on the internet, but that's why it's still there. And we would have probably moved to eliminate that, but it's in the statute, not in the regs.
I won't ask that for 3 years now.
So when you order the volume, Jason, for $30, right, you find out the government printing office is charging $35.
Right.
You'll be really upset. I just had one question, Jim. So we still have a specific reference adoption date. There's nothing in these changes makes it automatic adoption.
No.
In other words, when the federal regs are updated, it doesn't automatically update those. You still have to come through us with a date.
Right. It's okay. My understanding that that's not legal in the state of Nevada to have prospective adoption.
Okay.
We will come to you the next time we come with an adoption by reference instead of, well, in the past, it's been 17 or 18 entries. There should be a single one, 8632, that will encompass any number of changes. But actually, in the regs, it'll just be that one paragraph or section.
Okay.
Anyone else on the commission?
Yeah, I do, Jim. And I'm going to – do you have what we have here in the book on page 20? I just...
If you could, well, tell me what your page 20 is.
Okay, so it is the... It is 444-8632, so it's uh-huh. the one that you're referencing
yep.
everywhere here.
I have that in front of me.
And it is number 6. It looks like K. So it's the language that you've changed here where you've deleted. Identical
six.
Evidence of financial assurance must be submitted to and maintained with the regional administrator, replaced with, and then in the quotes you have the new language. I've read that 3 times and I don't understand what it says. I'm wondering what does that language mean? And it
okay.
refers to if someone has financial assurance in this state and another state that it has to
well,
be.
If I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead.
I thought yesterday when I was speaking with my colleague that if someone was going to ask a question, perhaps they're going to ask something about the tortured past of this passage. Originally, when our state regulations were drafted in 1985, we had in language that spoke to the sharing of information. It was concerned primarily with making sure that the state of Nevada got the information that they needed in financial assurance documents. EPA reviewed ours and I guess many other states and found that our language did not meet the federal minimum when it came to the exchange of information with other states. We wrote our regulations to make sure that Nevada had all the information that we needed, and I can't speak to what the thinking was in 1985, but we made sure we had the information and our people had what they needed. But the federal regulations had specific requirements that if you have a financial assurance document that covers facilities that are in more than one state, that there be equal sharing of information amongst all of those facilities. And we were not the only state that was deficient. In fact, EPA went so far as to draft guidance language and give it to the states. We took a look at that. We did our take on it. We sent it to LCB, and they did the final suggested wording. But the intent of that is to make sure that if we have a site in Nevada, some company that somehow has a facility in more than one state and using a single financial instrument for multiple sites, that the sharing of information will be equal. Everybody will get the
okay.
same information.
Okay.
I was also assured in conversations with our permit engineer that the omnibus portion of the RCRA Permitting Act spells out the permit will often have an even greater detail how information is to be shared and things like that. That it's never been a problem in practice. It was a theoretical concern that EPA brought to us, and we addressed it as best we could.
I think that answers it. So let me try to make that a word. Let's say a waste company like Waste Management
exactly.
has a dump in Lockwood and Utah and California, and they have one insurance company, and they issued a reclamation or surety bond for
exactly.
the reclamation. That surety bond had all three, and you have to share it with the other
right.
states.
If it covered more than one landfill,
okay.
we
okay.
that would be to ensure that all the information would be shared equally. And of course, as you can understand, we have a selfish concern to make sure that we in Nevada have what we think is most important, and then we will of course cooperate with the other states, but we have a proprietary interest, I think, to make sure that we meet our interests first and try to address the...
It's just tortuous language to say that.
Well, it's got a tortured history.
Thank you.
Did
yes.
LCB change your original language when you said that?
Yes. I believe if we were to look at, well, I don't know if I have it with it. I do. I think,
and
not to belabor
question.
The point, if you were to look at our submittal to LCB in June, it is different from what we sent them, and we are not lawyers, they are. What we took from EPA's suggested language, because apparently, like I said, there were many states, we used word substitution, and they came back and said, your word substitutions don't work for this state. You're only covering your own state. You're not thinking about your fellows. And we went back and changed. So it is probably slightly different. Without rereading it right now, I couldn't tell you exactly. But
and then was EPA okay with the changes that LCD made?
Yeah, I think they're okay with it.
As convoluted as they are. Okay.
Well, and the other thing to deal with, EPA, we deal with lawyers, and we are not lawyers on staff here, so we try and sometimes translate back, and then we pass it to LCD, as you well know. But we're trying to make it layman friendly. Perhaps not.
And you failed miserably.
I'll leave that up to you guys. With that, I would recommend approval.
Other comments from the committee? Okay, I will ask for any comments from the Carson City audience. Anybody here have any comments? Okay, seeing none, I'm going to ask for the same comments or comments from the Las Vegas office. Is there anybody down there that has comments on this item? Okay, I hear none, so I'm assuming there isn't. Okay, what is the pleasure of the commission, please?
Mr. Chairman, I would move the adoption of petition R091-16.
Okay. As proposed, any second on that?
I'll second.
Okay, there's a second. So it's been made and seconded that we approve petition R091-16. Any discussion on the motion? All those in favor, signify by aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? None. Motion carries. Thank you very much. Mr. Emmy, I want to just make a quick comment. When I went through all these proposed regulatory changes, I found that Form 1 and Form 4 were very enlightening. And I just want to compliment. I'm trying to redeem myself from my comment I made this morning earlier. I found that those were filled out. And you're filled out well and provide a lot of information. So I appreciate what I saw your name signed to them. So I'm appreciating any efforts you have in that area of staff, because I think it helps us a lot to clarify what we're doing. So thank you very much. Okay, on to item number 6. This is LCD file number R084-16, Bureau of Air Quality Planning and Bureau of Air Quality Control.
Good morning, Chairman Gans, members of the Commission. My name is Jeff Kinder. I'm the Chief of Bureau of Air Pollution Control. I'm here this morning with Danilo Dragoni, Chief of the Bureau of Air Quality Planning. The two air bureaus have two regulatory petitions we would like to present for approval and adoption today. The first petition, R084-16, is going to be very similar to the petition that you just heard. This is a routine update to NAC 445B.221, adoption by reference. This routine update will allow us to request delegation for the implementation of new and revised federal regulations. The federal regulations that we are proposing are 40 CFR Part 51 that addresses state implementation plans, Part 52, which addresses prevention of significant deterioration, Part 60, standards of performance for new stationary sources, and Part 63, national emission standards for hazardous air pollutants. It's important to note that these federal rules are already in place and Nevada stationary sources are already required to comply with them. What we're asking today through adoption is to allow the Bureau of Air Pollution to continue to be the permitting authority for our stationary sources in Nevada. There's no added economic impacts for this update. The regulations do not overlap, duplicate, or conflict with any other regulations. And the proposed regulation is no more stringent than federal regulations. We conducted a public workshop on June 7th with our other petition that we're going to be talking about next. While that was well attended, there were no questions pertaining to this petition. And with that, I'd ask if there are any questions.
Any questions from the commission, please? I have one of the things that we're doing a little differently is we're doing the agenda items now, so the commission can have one sheet of paper. minor fiscal impact, it says none. I'm sure that's the case. But whenever I look at fiscal impact, I look at three areas. I look at the fiscal impact to the public, and I look at the fiscal impact to the businesses, industry, and then also to the agency. So I'm assuming in this particular case where it says none, that that is true for all three of those areas. You're just making some changes that I understand that EPA needs us to become compliant with.
That is correct. These rules change quite often. In fact, we went through adoption in 2015 as well. As these new rules become effective, as we go through our normal permit revision renewal cycles, when we make the updates. So there's no intended added economic impact to any of the entities.
Okay. Back to the commission. Any other comments, questions from the commission?
I have one question for Mr. Kinder. At the public workshops, were there any comments from the public, questions, concerns, or anything?
Not pertaining to adoption by reference, but our next petition, there was quite a bit of comments and questions.
But as far as this one goes, there wasn't.
Correct.
Okay. Gotcha.
Okay, how about the Carson City audience? Any comments? Anyone in the audience? Okay, seeing none, we'll move to the Las Vegas office. Any comments from the Las Vegas office on this
no.
item? Okay. Thank you very much. Back to commission. What is the pleasure of the commission, please?
Mr. Chairman, I'd move to approve regulatory petition R084-16.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded to approve this petition. Any comments, discussion on the motion by the commission? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by aye.
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 Opposed? None. Petition passes. Thank you very much. Okay, we'll go on to item number 7. You're going to stay seated and provide this, okay?
That's correct. Thank you. Our second petition is R085-16. This petition is to reform the Class 2, Class 3, and Class 4 operating permitting provisions in an effort to streamline our air quality operating permitting programs and align the resources spent on permit applications with benefit to air quality. A little background on this issue. The Bureau of Air Pollution Control currently requires an air quality operating permit for any stationary source. And any stationary source is defined as any facility that emits a regulated air pollutant or has the potential to emit regulated air pollutants. The only current exception in our regulation is insignificant activities, and these are activities that are so small there's no significant impact on ambient air quality standards, so they don't require permits. We currently have 4 permitting programs based on the stationary sources permitted emissions. Our Class 1 program, which is major sources, those are facilities with permitted emissions greater than 100 tons per year. Under the Clean Air Act, these are the types of facilities that would require a Title V permit. We have a Class 2 minor source permitting program, and that's for facilities with permitted emissions less than 100 tons per year. We have a Class 3 permitting program, which is basically a subset of our Class 2 permitting program, and that's for sources that emit less than 5 tons per year. And finally, we have a Class 4 program that exists because certain facilities, small facilities, are subject to national emission standards for hazardous air pollutants. And what we do in our Class 4 program is overlay a state permit on top of a federal regulation. We currently have 1,000 permitted facilities. What we are proposing today is to revise the definition of our Class 2 stationary sources by establishing a threshold where a permitting would no longer be required. Now, these sources would still be subject to all air quality regulations and demonstrate compliance with the ambient air quality standards and any federal regulations. We would just not be going through the administrative step of adding a permit on top of these existing regulations. What we would be doing, however, is doing outreach with these facilities regularly to ensure that they understand their requirements under the VATA code as well as any federal regulations and to ensure they remain in compliance. We would transition approximately 250 sources in our Class 3 program and 250 sources in our Class 4 program. And I believe there's some handouts that were present at our public workshop that describes what we are proposing. So basically 420 of the facilities in these two programs would no longer need a permit. However, we would work with them on a regular basis through outreach to ensure that they continue to comply with all applicable requirements.
You pulled up this morning. Is this the right one?
Yes,
you're
correct.
Talking about? Okay, I want to make sure we're up. Okay, good. We're on the same page. Thank you very much.
So again, approximately 420 facilities would no longer require a permit. the remaining 80 facilities approximately would then transition into our Class 2 permitting program as true minor sources. However, many of those sources would qualify for a general permit, which would reduce the amount of permitting required. They would still require a Class 2 permit, but it would be a general permit. We currently have a general permit for the construction industry that we have maintained for many years, and we're proposing 4 to 5 additional categories as part of this. We still have to go through the rulemaking for that as well. One particular industry, gas dispensing, we've already created a general permit, and that was available at our public workshop, so facilities could see what a general permit would look like and what it would entail. Finally, very few of the facilities would transition into our Class 2 permitting program as true minor sources. These facilities have large potential to emit, and they've taken severe restrictions to be in our current Class 3 program. So while there's a little bit more involved with permitting in the Class 2 program, these facilities should realize some flexibility in their operation without having to maintain that 5 tons per year. Additionally, this regulatory petition has a couple other changes that pertain to our Class 2 public notice requirements. Currently in our Class 1 major source permitting program, we receive an application, we create an admission inventory, we draft a permit, and then we seek public participation and comment on the permit we've drafted. Our Class 2 program is just reversed, where we seek comment on the application currently, and the public does not get a chance to comment on permit that we draft, and we're asking to reverse that order to match our Class 1 source. In addition, we're asking to expand the coverage for sensitive populations that would also require public participation where they currently don't in our current regulations. So if a facility is proposed within 1,000 feet of a school or a residence, we would be required to conduct public participation. With that, Danilo will continue on.
Yes. Hi. For the record, my name is Danilo Dragoni. Good morning. I'd like just to spend a few words talking about how we got to those emission threshold. Of course, we had to do some modeling exercise, and what we did, we basically simulated a few typical Class 3 sources here in Nevada using our air pollution dispersion model. And in conditions that are typical topography for Nevada, if there is such a thing, and using 30 years of meteorological data kind of generate that kind of sort of variability that you want to see when you do this kind of exercise. Once we run this model, we compare the concentration result given by the emissions with the Nevada and federal standards, and we made very sure that the maximum concentration that we saw were well below the standard. So in that way, we were sure that the threshold that we are proposing will be we produce concentration that are well below the standards and will be protective of the Nevada and federal standards, and of course air quality. We also, as Jeff mentioned, we are planning to start an outreach program. About 80% of the current Class 4 and Class 3 facility will basically not need any permit anymore. So the outreach would allow us to basically keep informing and helping this facility if they need help. We are currently planning to outsource the outreach program. But of course, we are going to be always available in case this facility needs our assistance. And we will retain, of course, the enforcement capability as well. Finally, in terms of workshop, I just like to add that indeed we had a workshop on June 7 of 2016, but the entire process had started almost a year before, and we already started at that time. We already started contacting stakeholders, in particular industry and mining association, in order to kind of develop this regulation in kind of concordance and agreement. Several changes were proposed even before the workshop, and we adopt them because they made sense. And during the workshop, we mainly had questions about the implementation of the regulation rather than discussing on the regulation itself. So we found that has been very positive because, again, the entire development of this proposed regulation happened way before the workshop. During the workshop, we had a representative of the industry, mining association, small business, and with this, I conclude my. There are questions?
Questions by the commission.
Yeah, I have a few. But first, let me comment, because I spent some time looking at this yesterday, and I think this is really good work. I love to see chapters cleaned up like this, and to go from you know, four air permit classifications to really two with subsets. Having been on the other side of this at times with PSD permits, I think makes a lot of sense, and to be able to let go of, what did you say the total number were of class four and class three that you estimated?
Approximately about 420.
400, of which are all going to be small businesses, basically. Really, correct. Really small emitters that you're probably spending a lot of time on. Just makes great economic sense and still is protective of the environment. So I applaud you for the work that you put into this. My second question is just for clarification. So you're going to have a class one and class two. Does class one have two subsets? It's PSD class one and then class one below PSD, basically, right?
Yeah. Okay. Jeff Kinder, for the record, that's an excellent question. So if a facility is over 250 tons per year, permitted emissions, they will become what's called a major stationary source. And as you said, they're PSD and have a different set of permitting. In Nevada, it's just class one. But federally, there are additional requirements for large emitters.
And class two has two subsets. It's a class two and then a class two general, which you said you're going to have types of class two general permits, right?
Yeah, again, Jeff Kinder, for the record, that is correct. Our regs already authorized us to create general permits, and our intention is to create between four and five general permits for specific industry groups.
It would be good when you do roll this out to the public. I mean, this kind of says it here, but if you could put, here's the new and here's the old, and kind of, because I was drawing that out myself trying to figure out. The second question.
I want to echo that, what you just said. I think that'd be a very good idea.
My second question is knowing that Clark and Washoe oversee Clean Air Act themselves, right? Because you guys do it in the other 15 counties.
Right.
Is this applicable to those, or do they have different regulations?
Jeff Kinder, again, for the record. Clark County has gone through a similar type of regulatory change establishing thresholds. So our request here today will be very similar to how Clark County is currently administering the Clean Air Act in Clark County. Washoe County is quite a bit different on how they implement their program, so there's not a lot of similarities between our two programs.
Okay. But they don't use they don't reference your regulations, basically. They have their own.
That's correct.
Okay. And my last question, this is consistent with Clean Air Act, EPA, and all of that, these changes.
Yeah, Jeff Kinder, again, for the record, that is correct, and we will have to go through implementing these changes into our state implementation program as part of this regulatory change.
Thank you.
Yes, I'd also like to commend the division for making these changes as well, especially in light of the fact that most of all, not all of the areas that you regulate are in attainment. Is that correct?
Yep, this is the Dragoni, that's correct.
Right, okay. So
currently all of them are in attainment.
Right, and this is similar to the way the division issued permits a number of years ago, isn't it, as well? So kind of what's
is
old
correct.
Is new again here.
Correct.
So, all right. again, I applaud your work on this, and I think it'll make a big difference in those small businesses that are impacted by these, and also your division with regard to resources and really applying your resources to the areas that need to be applied to, like major sources.
Yes, correct.
When a number of these smaller businesses found out that they weren't going to have air permits or have to comply like that, were you invited to any celebrations?
No.
Do you feel confident by making any changes? And I really appreciate what Tom's saying. Gold is new, new is old. Do you feel confident that this will give us as much control as we need for the environment? I guess I'm just speaking now, it's just environment. At least as much or more, I realize you're going to be able to use your resources a lot more effectively. But I always have to ask the environmental question. Is our whole job here is let's watch the environment. You're confident that this will take care of anything that needs to be taken care of.
Jeff Kinder, for the record, again, I think through the modeling analysis right. we did, we're confident we will be protective of the Nevada and national ambient air quality standards. I also do believe through outreach we will get a better level of compliance with small businesses, because many of these small permits often look like much larger permits, and they're complex, and to people who aren't dealing with air regulations every day, it's very difficult for them to understand their requirements, and I think through outreach we will be able to improve compliance.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question. You say that you will continue to engage in enforcement against with non-permitted businesses, and I'm just curious if there will be any significant or substantial change in the way you monitor or engage in enforcement as a result of this change, or will monitoring occur in the same way that it would under the old schematic?
Jeff Kinder again for the record. We will continue to monitor in the same way and reach out to facilities in the same way as we have when we currently are doing permitting. Our first goal is always compliance, working with facilities.
Additional comments, questions? Okay, then I'll ask the Carson City audience if anybody in the audience would like to speak on this. Seeing none, we'll go to the Las Vegas office. Does anybody down there want to comment or speak about this?
Yes, somebody has a comment, stand up.
Okay, proceed.
They can't see. I don't know if you are here, they can't see you. You'll have to say your name.
For the record, this is Darla Lacey. I'm the Vice President of Environmental Safety and Land Resources for NV Energy. And I'd just like to say we support the adoption of this particular regulatory petition. I'd also like to commend the division as well as the bureau chief for the consultation process. As noted by Dr. Gripster, they spent actually over a year with this consultation process, and it was really outstanding communication throughout with all of the stakeholders. So we appreciate it very much, and thank you very much.
Thank you for the comments. Are you sure you're with Nevada Energy? I'm kidding. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Okay. Anyone on the commission?
I have one question, Mr. Chairman. So what's the process in informing the permittees of this pending change? Because as you spoke to, a lot of it is good news, but still it's different. And these regulations for smaller companies are already difficult to understand. So how do they get informed? What's that process?
Jeff Kinder, for the record. Our intention will be through this outreach, whether we do it internally or contract it out, is to contact each of the facilities once this regulation becomes permanent, advise them of the changes and the steps it will take to either transition out of the program or transition to a different class of permit. For facilities that will be transitioning into the Class 2 permit, whether a regular Class 2 or Class 2 general, they'll be in their normal permitting timeline. So as their permit comes up for renewal at that time, we'll transition them to the new permitting class.
There'll be an actual individual that reaches out, helps kind of shepherd them through the process.
That is correct.
Thank you.
And that occurs over, as I recall, a 5-year period, right?
That's
the
correct
whole thing.
Okay, what's the commission's pleasure, please?
I would move, Mr. Chairman, that we adopt petition number R085-16 as presented.
Is there a second?
Second.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded that we adopt this regulatory petition. Any discussion and comments on the motion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by aye.
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 Opposed? None. Motion carried.
Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. Okay, we're going on to number 8, is that correct? This is with the Bureau of Air Quality Planning for LCB file number R098-16.
Good morning again. For the records, my name is Danilo Dragoni. I'm the Chief of Air Quality Planning. With me is Sig Jan Rice, Supervisor of the Smoke, Mobiles, and Greenhouse Gas Branch. If we don't have any technical problems, we should be able to have a small presentation that kind of describe the intent of this proposed regulation.
Are the people in Las Vegas going to be able to see this?
No, but they were provided with the handouts.
They should be very
right.
Careful when you're going through this, where you are on the screen. Okay,
absolutely. Yeah. Yes. Do I need to do something to swap?
No, you shouldn't.
I shouldn't. Okay. 30.
Our whole cloud, this new cloud system, messing stuff in the EP cloud system.
We can start. You do have all the slides, so we can. That's correct. Yeah. I mean, I can try to fix it as we are talking. Yes, that's correct. That's the presentation.
Let's continue with this because Vegas has the same thing.
Okay. Yeah, I have it. Sick.
Just refer to it clearly so we know where you are.
It's here, huh?
Yeah.
Okay.
I apologize for this. That's...
Guess I'm not going to need that. Once again, good morning. Sig Yownerice with NDEP's Bureau of Air Quality Planning. This morning we're presenting our proposed amendments to NAC 46A, the Alternative Fuels and Fleets Program. So moving on to slide number two, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to take just a few minutes to go over some of the basics of this program, what its intent was, how it's put together. And I think that will then set the stage for why we are asking for the amendments we're asking for today.
And this slide is entitled Nevada Alternative Fuel and Fleet Program?
In program, yes, yes.
Okay.
So slide number two, this program was created by the Nevada legislature in 1991 for air quality purposes. And at that time, our two largest counties were in non-attainment for carbon monoxide pollution. So they're failing to maintain the federal standards. So the Nevada legislature created this program as a way to help air quality planners get the counties in compliance with carbon monoxide standards. This is a Nevada-specific program. No other state has a program quite like this. It applies to 21 state and local government fleets that have 50 vehicles or greater based in Clark or Washoe County. So it's the largest city and state and county government fleets, including the school districts, transit bus fleets, city and county general services and public works fleets, the universities, and NDOT. The program requires that 90% of new vehicles acquired by these fleets be capable of running on alternative fuels, and then they have to run those alternative fuels as they use those vehicles. The program exempts law enforcement, fire, and emergency vehicles. So moving on to slide three, the currently allowable fuels are shown here, including some of the fuels you may be familiar with as alternative fuels, including biodiesel, electricity, ethanol, which is E85, it's the alcohol fuel that's made mainly from corn in the Midwest. Hydrogen, which is really an experimental fuel because you can't buy any cars that run on hydrogen currently. Compressed natural gas and propane. In addition, there are a couple fuels that are a little more Nevada specific, including on the left, G diesel, which is a form of diesel fuel that's made in small quantities here in northern Nevada. And on the far right, RFG. RFG stands for reformulated gasoline. It is a slightly cleaner formulation of conventional gasoline that is used by the state of California to help with their serious air quality problems in that state. And we have a gasoline alternative in our program because from the very beginning of this program, it was recognized that you simply can't run a fleet without some gasoline alternative because that's what Detroit makes, largely are gasoline-powered vehicles. In addition to these alternative fuels, we also allow hybrids such as the Prius and what are called EPA SmartWay vehicles. These are vehicles that EPA has given a special designation to, the SmartWay designation, signifying that they are especially low emission vehicles. But both hybrids and SmartWay vehicles burn conventional gasoline. The fleets must provide NDEP annual reports on fuel usage and vehicle acquisitions to demonstrate compliance. Moving to slide four, this is a chart of the different affected vehicles by fuel type. And we present this to you just to give you an idea of how this program has evolved over time with the different fuels, how it's been difficult at times for fleets to comply with the program with the changing environment of what is available in alternative fuels. So our number one fuel in terms of vehicles that use the fuel is in purple there. It's biodiesel or G-diesel, and that's largely due to the large number of transit bus vehicles and school buses. Our second most used fuel is in teal there. That's that RFG that I mentioned. At the bottom of the chart, you'll see in kind of a rust color the CNG, compressed natural gas, and in red, propane. Those are two fuels that in the early years showed great promise in terms of their cleanliness. CNG is an exceptionally clean fuel. However, in 2004, the big three Detroit auto manufacturers stopped manufacturing light-duty vehicles in a CNG and a propane configuration. So over the years, the numbers of vehicles in those two types of fuels has waned, and we only see them now in some transit buses and shuttle buses operated by the two RTCs. Finally, rounding out the list at the very top, you'll see in bright blue hybrids, which have come on strong as a choice for the fleets, and some E85 vehicles in green, and some electric and smartway vehicles. Moving on to slide five.
Before you get off the slide,
sure.
I noticed that the dedicated diesel is only in the year 2015. Why is that?
Those are actually diesel vehicles that we're counting that have received variances from the commission. So just as a way of record keeping, they were allowed to burn conventional diesel fuel because of the variance. So on five.
Let me ask another question.
Okay.
I also note that in 2015, the affected vehicles have dropped.
Yes.
Why is that?
Well, looking at those years, we started off with about 2,000 vehicles, and as these cities have grown, it has gone up. But there was a statute change made, and I think it was the 2013 legislative session, that changed the number of vehicles that brought a fleet into under this program. So it used to be that fleets that had 10 or more vehicles were covered under this program. That was changed to 50 or more vehicles. So a number of vehicles dropped out, and I think it wasn't until 2015 that we started, you know, recording that number.
Thank you.
So on slide five, our agency has recognized for some time that NEC 486A has been out of step with developments in cleaner conventional fuels and clean vehicle technologies. Stricter federal emission standards for new light-duty and heavy-duty motor vehicles have been instituted by the feds. In addition, cleaner conventional gasoline and diesel fuels mandated by federal regulation have come on the scene. So because of just these two items, our cities in Nevada, and really all the cities across the country that were in non-compliance with carbon monoxide standards are now in compliance and have been in compliance since the early 2000s. Our program has attempted to adapt by allowing hybrid and smartway vehicle technologies, again, in terms of hybrids, a breakthrough technology, even though these vehicles burn conventional gasoline. So moving on to slide six, the issue is reformulated gasoline. It's the reason we're here today. A change in federal fuel standards that takes effect in January of 2017, will require all gasoline sold in the U.S. to meet the same standards as California Phase 3 reformulated gasoline. So essentially, what that means is that the feds are, in effect, adopting the California formulation for fuel and saying every fueling station in the country will have to sell that same formulation.
What's the difference between regular gas and reformulated gas?
The difference is the California fuel has about 8 parameters, and these are chemical parameters, physical and chemical properties of the fuel that are adjusted in a way to lower emissions. And it requires some extra steps in the refining process, and it's actually one of the reasons that California fuel costs more there. But for a long time, California has had the cleanest gasoline in the world, and now the feds are adopting that standard. So what that will mean is that conventional gasoline that will be required to be sold in Nevada and every other state will, by federal mandate, equal the highest emission reduction standards in the world. So there will be no cleaner alternative for gasoline-powered engines. So that presents a bit of a conundrum for us, because are we to require fleets to continue to go over to California to buy reformulated gasoline when the same fuel essentially is going to be available by a local supplier? So moving to the next slide, slide 7, we determined that perhaps this was a good time for a reset of the 486A program, a reset that is intended to modernize the program, bring it in line with current technology and fuel standards, and at the same time redirect or refocus our efforts towards achieving the legislative goal of reducing emissions from public fleets. So moving to the next slide, we see a reset as being, first of all, emphasizing those other traditional alternative fuels that I listed in place of RFG, which now becomes the standard gasoline fuel. We would propose to adjust the acquisition percentage to establish a more practical goal for alternative fuel fleet makeup. We are also proposing to provide incentives for battery electric and plug-in electric hybrids, likely the next major trend in vehicle technology, and something that we feel will dovetail nicely with the governor's Nevada Electric Highway Initiative. So moving to the next slide, slide 9, the reset includes these changes summarized here. First of all, we're proposing to eliminate RFG as an alternative fuel. And so what that means is the fleets will not be able to use RFG or to show us that their use of RFG is complying with the acquisition standard. However, we also propose to grandfather in existing RFG vehicles. And so what that means is those fleets that have gasoline-powered vehicles for which they've been using RFG, they'll now be able to use conventional gasoline, which will be RFG starting in January. We also propose to change the required acquisition percentage from the current 90% to 20%. Now, this is a big, big change, and in a subsequent slide, we're going to walk through our reasoning there. We also propose to revise reporting requirements. We're proposing to add 2 diesel alternative fuels. One of them is renewable diesel that's now available in our region and some fleets have been asking about. We're proposing to provide incentives for battery electric and plug-in hybrid electric vehicle acquisitions. And what that means is we're proposing to give the fleets a kind of a 2-for-1. So if they buy a battery electric vehicle, it will count towards 2 vehicle acquisitions towards their percentage requirement.
What do you mean by battery electric?
By battery electric, we mean fully electric vehicles. And so that would include the Nissan Leaf, the Tesla vehicles that I know are pretty expensive for fleets, but their prices are going to come down. The new Chevy Bolt with a B is in Bravo. That's a fully electric vehicle. And by plug-in electric vehicles, we mean vehicles such as the Chevy Volt with a V. Most of the manufacturers are making plug-in electrics now. The Toyota Prius is available. Ford makes a version, I think, of their Fusion. So again, a kind of a 2-for-1 to incentivize moving towards electric vehicles. We also propose to update and expand the definition of clean vehicle. But we want to emphasize here that nothing we have proposed will negatively impact air quality. We really feel strongly about that.
Even this percentage?
Yes.
It's a big percentage.
It is a big percentage, but once again, the gasoline vehicles that they're using, they're going to be using the same fuel they're using right now. So moving on to the next slide, why change the acquisition percentage from the current 90% to 20%? Most fleets would have some difficulty in making the 90% requirement without RFG because there's so many vehicles that are gasoline powered that they're using to help make that 90% requirement. Several fleets have a very high percentage of RFG vehicles, some fleets up to 100%. And that includes the University of Nevada, Reno, and the Washoe County General Services fleet. And we found in our discussions with the fleets that a number of fleets, mainly in Washoe County, use more RFG than down in Las Vegas. And there's a reason for that. The reason is in Las Vegas, they've been buying a lot more hybrid vehicles because they don't need all-wheel drive. In the north, they want all-wheel drive vehicles to provide essential services during snowy weather. And all-wheel drive vehicles are just not available in a hybrid form. They are available in a gasoline form. If you go to a diesel vehicle, you're talking a full-size three-quarter ton pickup truck, and that's not what they want. So for these fleets, they'll have difficulty complying with any alternative fuel acquisition requirement outside of having RFG. So in discussions, we thought 20% would be a practical compromise that some of the fleets, let's say the RTCs, they'll be able to make that 20% pretty easily because they're just running diesel-powered buses and they have some CNG buses. But for fleets like the universities, it'll be tough. But we have built in a kind of phase-in period to give them several years' opportunity to meet that 20% requirement. The other thing we'd like to point out is that in following along with the idea of a reset, the acquisition percentage could be increased above 20% in future years if alternative fuel options and availability increase. And we're thinking primarily battery vehicles here, or electric vehicles. Right now you're just seeing sedans, but in the coming years, we think you'll see more pickup trucks and SUVs that are made in an electric configuration. So moving to the next slide with the air quality perspective, I'll throw it back to Daniel.
This is Daniel Dragoni for the record. I'm just going to conclude with the next two slides on slides 11. I just want to give most of this has been already said, but I want to just give a kind of a wide perspective in terms of air quality and quality planning. We believe that the big changes that we're going to make, the adoption of the standard gasoline and the switch from 90% to 20% requirement will not affect at all the emissions from this fleet, and so we believe that these changes will be at least neutral in terms of air quality. However, the fact that we are adding more options in the zero-emission vehicles, we believe that that might bring some benefits as well, so in terms of air quality and reduction of emission for this fleet. And finally, we believe that those also, as Sig already mentioned, this kind of reset is in line with some more broader state strategies like the electric highway, and definitely with some of the market tendency that we are seeing in terms of hybrid vehicles and electric cars. I'm switching to the last slide, slide 12. And again, I just want to provide a little bit of details about the workshop and the stakeholder outreach that we have done. As in the previous case, we started our outreach well before the workshop. We had meetings with the fleet managers in Vegas and Carson City a month before the workshop, trying to kind of hear what they had to say about our proposal. We've made adjustments and changes. We got to the workshop, it was held on June. And again, I'd like to point out that this was a kind of culmination of nearly a year's of efforts of communication with stakeholders, in particular with Fleet. We had a couple of comments after the workshop. In specific, one was from VESPA, the Western States Petroleum Association. They had a comment about we originally intended to, and please see, correct me if I'm saying something wrong, we originally intended to hold the blend stock for renewable diesel at 99%. They came forward and they showed that actually even with 20%, there was a benefits in terms of reduction in emissions. So we, that was an independent study done by CARB. So we believe that that was fair and enough to move from our from original idea of 99% blend stock to 20%. We had also some comments from one of the fleet concerning, well, questions and concerning the telematics that we are adding in this regulation. There was some questions about usefulness of this approach. We kind of spoke with them, we clarified, and we do believe that allowing telematics in this program will help reducing emissions. We'll provide fleet managers another tool so that they can and will be able to reduce emissions in their fleet.
I might just add to what Danilo said there, vehicle telematics. In keeping with the legislative intent of reducing emissions from fleets, one of the things that we looked at was new technologies and practices that can address that. So there's something out there called vehicle telematics that some fleets are beginning to adopt. And what it is essentially is a device that can be plugged into all the vehicles in a fleet, and it's monitoring all these different parameters every day on that vehicle and sending that information back to a fleet manager on a daily or weekly basis. So there are ways that a fleet manager can change the fleet practices that would reduce emissions, including a vehicle telematics system will flag if any part of the emission control system goes bad. So the fleet manager will know it right away, and they can repair it right away, rather than waiting 6 months or a year for the smog check program to catch that. Another thing a vehicle telematics system can do is it can flag excessive idling. And so a fleet manager can go to the supervisor of whoever's driving and saying, look, why are you idling 20 minutes, 30 minutes a day? It wastes fuel, it creates higher emissions. Another way a vehicle telematics system can be used is with vehicle routing. If a fleet sees their vehicles are taking a circuitous route through a city, that's wasting fuel, that's creating more emissions. They can work to improve the efficiency of their vehicle routing.
How widespread is the use of this?
Right now, it's being used in a few fleets. I think NV Energy, that's not subject to our program, is using it. It mainly has been adopted by private fleets. But I believe some fleets are interested that are public fleets as well.
Is it expensive for the public fleets?
It is an expense. And I want to say, and I look back to Joe here, is it
$25? From my discussion with the fleets, Joe Ferra, NDP for the record, my discussion with the fleets, it was $25 a vehicle, I believe.
So there's a monthly service fee per vehicle, and then there may be some fee for the software and sort of general fee for the whole program.
It's about, I think it was like $300 per GPS unit, and then I think we pay about $35 a month for it.
Okay.
Does that conclude your presentation?
It does, sir.
So it's the commission's turn. I would open up any comments or questions from commissioners. Tom?
Yeah, I've got a few, Mr. Chairman. First of all, that 90%, if I recall, when this law was passed by the legislature, somewhat dovetailed with Department of Energy's requirement for fleets to reduce their fuel requirements to make America less dependent on foreign oil, if I recall. And so at the same time, I think that 90% is found in the DOE requirement, and that's where that 90% came from, which at the time I thought was quite excessive. So anyway, moving on, with regard to Clark and Washoe County and their state implementation plans for meeting attainment status, did you confer with them and convey to them that this is not going to be an issue? And will they have to change their SIPs as a result of this? Because I believe they use part of this regulation probably in their SIP and submittals to EPA.
Do you want to answer that? Or I
go ahead.
I we did confer with Clark and Washoe County on this. Washoe County does not have it at all in their SIP. Clark County has it in their carbon monoxide SIP as a contingency measure. And as a contingency measure, it's not quantifiable. The EPA cannot quantify what the emissions reduction benefit is of this program. And really, it is very difficult to quantify, if any. So that's why whenever a variance has come before the commission, you'll see Clark County saying, this program or this variance will not affect their SIP. They just can't count on this SIP to reduce emissions, put it that way.
It's interesting. I wondered what they based it on. I mean, when they give out those letters, like for North Las Vegas.
Like I said, it's because they can't quantify what the benefit is. It's not calculable.
Which is interesting because, you know, if we're looking at to improve air quality, someone like Clark County, who's been in non-attainment for several years, would want to use some type of credit towards getting attainment, and they can't even use this. So, you know, it begs the question how effective a tool this is, other than, like I said, getting back to the DOE question of lessening our reliance on foreign oil. And that's when this all came about, and they said, hey, it'd also be a good air program, too. And but the original intent came through the Department of Energy in this fleet requirements and reducing the foreign reliance on foreign oil.
I think what Chairman Porter or Commissioner Porter is referring to is there's a federal alternative fuel program called EPACT, which is Energy Policy Act, and it applies to federal fleets and some large state fleets, and it requires use of alternative fuel or it requires the fleets to acquire alternative fuel capable vehicles, but they don't actually have to use the fuels. So to demonstrate compliance, they buy those vehicles that say flex fuel vehicle on the back, and they're in compliance.
So in the big picture, what does this kind of program have on the carbon footprint? I know that's very general, but we hear a lot about that.
Well, any vehicle that uses fossil fuels is contributing to CO2 emissions. There are some vehicles that are fuels that are less. CNG probably produces a little less than a diesel or a gasoline-powered vehicle. An electric-powered vehicle produces none, but when you look at where does the electricity come from, then you get into the discussion of, well, maybe it's from a coal-fired power plant. If we generate all our electricity from solar power and wind power, then there will be no carbon footprint. Some of the vehicles, like the Smart Way vehicles, EPA gives that designation not only for their what we call criteria pollutant emissions, which are carbon monoxide and NOx and particulate matter, but part of the scoring is for CO2 emissions. So if you're buying one of those vehicles, you're doing your part as far as reducing CO2.
Any questions?
What's G diesel? I know what biodiesel is, but what's G diesel?
G diesel is made by a little company out here just east of Sparks. Anyway, a small company that has come up with an innovative way of re-refining diesel fuel. So what they do is without getting too technical, they take diesel fuel, they heat it to about 300 degrees, which creates a vapor. They pass that vapor through windings of precious metals, like platinum metals, which is kind of what you're doing in your catalytic converter. They then condense that vapor, producing a fuel. They also bubble natural gas through there, which the chemists tell me they don't quite understand, but they produce a fuel which has been tested, and we've looked at these test results, to reduce NOx and NOx, nitrous oxide component, contaminants. That's important because NOx contributes to ozone, which our two cities are going to be facing as a contaminant concern here in the future.
How much more does it cost them to do that?
Interestingly enough, I believe they are very competitive with the price on that fuel. And the reason is when they go through this process, at the end of the process, they have 10% more fuel than they put in. Somehow the natural gas plays into this. I've gone out and seen the process. It's interesting. But I think that's part of the reason. They have 10% more fuel at the end.
How much do you produce and how much is used?
Their operation is very small. I want to say they're in the tens of thousands of gallons. And they've had a bit of a hiccup involving how the fuel is taxed. Through no fault of their own, it's my understanding that the Department of Motor Vehicles that assesses fuel taxes, we're treating them one way and then said, wait a minute, you need to pay the tax another way. And so they had to shut down production. But I can tell you when they were producing, we have several fleets down in Las Vegas who were using it who really liked it. They liked it better than the biodiesel.
So is it specific just to Nevada? You can't buy it anywhere else? This is the only plant? Or
I think this is the only plant. It was my understanding they wanted to build a plant in Las Vegas, and if the fuel takes off, I think this company wants to build them anywhere. Huh. But as my understanding, it's only available in Nevada right now.
Have they floated this fuel by Air Resources Board in California?
I don't know that. But what they provided to us was they went and they went to one of the there are independent labs in Southern California that do emissions testing for the automotive industry. So if you know one of the car companies wants to have their vehicle certified by the federal EPA, they go to these labs. So they had a diesel engine and they ran straight diesel fuel and they ran their fuel and did a very scientific, it's the same test that they do to certify vehicle engines. And they passed and showing this NOx reduction. So as per NAC 486A, which requires us to look at scientific evidence that a fuel actually produces fewer emissions, we determined that was a fuel that could be part of this program. Yeah, I don't know if they've gone to CARB, though.
Because it seems like, you know, the state of California would be all over this with regard to, like, the issues in L.A.
Mm-hmm.
Why would the company start here versus, you know, don't mean to be a skunk at the picnic, but this kind of curious, that's all.
Other commission?
I have a question. Is there a quantitative goal of this program? We have to reduce emissions by certain percentages, or is this just a more general to improve efficiency?
I would say the latter.
Yep.
There's never been a quantitative goal, and honestly, if we tried to quantify the benefits, I can't do it.
One of the things in here, you use the word trends because things are very dynamic in this industry, and one of the trends that you're really backing is a fully electric vehicle, which you certainly can make an argument you're trading a mobile pollution source for a stationary, utilizing an overtaxed infrastructure to deliver power and whatnot, and that trend may change. Does that create a problem here as we're looking at regulations and we're dealing with trends and backing specific types of technology over different types of No.
Go ahead.
I would answer that in this way. Remember, the intent of this program was to reduce emissions from fleets in our cities that have emission problems. Those are localized emission problems. So if we can still run vehicles that don't produce any emissions in our cities and produce the emissions elsewhere, where our Bureau of Air Pollution Control has to deal with them, maybe that's a benefit. But really, it's a larger societal question that, you know, maybe the legislature would need to deal with. But it's an interesting question.
Now, we've granted in the past, and there's one sitting here for next meeting, is these variances. So what do you foresee these revisions having an impact on those types of applications and ones that are already existing that were based on a completely different set of rules? Do we revisit those?
I would envision it having an impact, yes. I think fewer fleets will come to the commission to seek variances because they'll have more options with just the with being able to buy conventional gasoline vehicles to make up the 80% if that's what they do. I think it'll be more difficult for them to come and show that there's a financial burden on them. So, yeah, I do see that.
Do we revisit any existing variances that may still have a couple years to play out to see if those variances no longer apply because of new rules?
The commission could consider that. I want to say that there's only one fleet right now. Is that right? There's only one fleet that has an active variance. Those other past variances that have been granted have all expired, and those fleets have come into compliance. So is it Clark County?
Boulder City.
Oh, it's a Boulder City. Boulder City. And the issue with Boulder City was really no fault of their own. They had underground storage tanks that were leaking, and they were required by the county to remove those immediately. So once again, capital improvement project takes some time, you know, to get the money lined up and to do that. So.
But this is Danilo Dragoni for records. They are moving towards compliance, right?
Last we talked to them, yes, I believe so.
Mr. Chairman, I may show my ignorance of math, which is extreme, but I am concerned. I recognize from conversation that's gone on that the 90% number was perhaps not based on even environmental concerns, much less that there was a real basis for determining 90%. But the drop to 20% is pretty dramatic. And when you couple that with the twofer provision, I'm curious if the two of them combined will substantially, the 20% plus the twofer that you get to have, if you buy one really clean car, you get to have a regular car, essentially, counting as though it were a clean car. If that really reduces the percentage even lower than 20%, if you take advantage of the twofer provision. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yes.
Do they interact together that way? Am I hearing that right? And you know, allowing for all of the concerns about whether we can measure any of this, that seems to me that might be fairly dramatic.
Yes, I understand what you're saying, and it possibly might. One thing I'll point out is the way that we assess compliance is we round up. So if a fleet only buys one vehicle in a year, to make that 20%, that one vehicle has to be alt fuel. If they only buy two vehicles in a year, and some of our smaller fleets, they'll only buy a couple of vehicles. One vehicle must be alt fuel. One must can be, you know, conventional. So there, that's 50% compliance, and so on. But yes, they could use the two for one advantageously.
But this is Daniel Dragoni, for the record. We see that quite unlikely. I believe that this drop in percentage was also done to kind of, to some extent, accommodate for the for the RFG to be pulled out from the program. So, I mean, it is likely that some of this fleet that might take the one for one, they might buy an electric car and then use buy a gasoline car, which in this case we still use the equivalent of a RFG. So it would be still clean with respect to the gasoline, of course.
Bring me up to speed a little bit. I'm probably two decades out of operation here, but when I used to have to be responsible for this program, complying with this program, these percentages changed over the years. That's not happening anymore?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, there was a phase-in period when the program began, and if I can remember correctly, it was something like the first year was 20%, the next year was 30, 40, 50%, and so on, until a few years went along and we got to 90% and we stayed at 90%.
And how come you're not following that type of logic with this percentage?
Well, we could. And we are leaving it open to be able to come back to the commission and increase the percentage. But I don't think we felt comfortable putting that down on paper at that point because of the pushback we received from some of the fleets, particularly in Washoe County. I mean, they were very concerned about just making 20%. So we left it at 20% with the idea we could revisit it in future.
Where's Clark County?
Clark County, most of the fleets, they do use RFG, but it's a much smaller percentage of the overall fuel that they use. They use a lot of biodiesel, and they use quite a few hybrids, actually. And again, it's because a two-wheel drive vehicle is just fine in Clark County.
I see a lot of Priuses driving around mm-hmm. with government locals on the site, so I understand what you're saying. Mm-hmm. I guess I'm like you, I'm concerned about this percentage. I appreciate yes. what you're saying about, because I tell you, we had a heck of a struggle, and it cost us a lot of money when I was working in government to meet these requirements. I mean, these vehicles are expensive, and we tried all kinds of stuff. We'd modify a vehicle, try to make, well, we got to put propane in this truck or something. You know? So I know what you're saying, but I'm concerned of where we're going with this. I hope that we're not going to take a step forward and three back is what I'm trying to ascertain when I look at this.
If I may, this is Daniel Dragoni for the records. We, Commissioner Richardson pointed out that one of the major problems we have is to define trends. And it's very hard right now define what's going to be the trends for the next 5-10 years in terms of electric cars. So we thought that we'd rather come here and maybe in 2 years, 3 years, if there is this kind of explosion of electric cars all over Nevada, and come back and say, look, the 20% now is pretty easy to, so let's move it to 30%, rather than defining in the regulation a trend that maybe might not be feasible or reasonable or might not match what the real trend in the future are going to be.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, I think one of my concerns, I tend to focus on the practical sides of these types of matters, and I would want some assurance that the gymnastics that we're going through is creating real calculus in terms of shifting the air quality in a meaningful way that can be seen. We spend a lot of time on an issue such as this, and like Commissioner Richardson said, technology is, the evolution curve on this is moving very rapidly right now. So I would caution against spending too much time on this because products and services may be available in 3 to 5 years that we haven't even thought of at this point that could go, you know, a much longer distance towards achieving higher quality air standards, you know, especially in Clark County where it's a much bigger problem than it is in Washoe County. But with the rate of change in technology, spending a tremendous amount of time looking at technologies that for all intents and purposes, will likely be obsolete in 3 to 5 years. Doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
And I'm struggling greatly with a program, and I know, again, came off the heels of the Department of Energy's requirement that it was going to be an air quality benefit. And since Washoe County doesn't use it in their SIP, Clark County uses it as a, I guess, what do you call it, a exception or
contingency measure.
Contingency measure, and you can't quantify that. I mean, you know, the purpose of regulation is to bring about some benefit. And I'm not seeing the benefit here in comparison to the cost that fleets have gone through to comply with. Now, maybe, again, to lessen the reliance on foreign oil, it's great. But as far as an air quality program, I'm just really struggling. And I know it came from the legislature, statute, right? Is this a program that, you know, should be sunset, you know, instead of continuing on into perpetuity, like so many of these things do? And I don't know. It's difficult.
And I know, as someone that had to work under this, we were spending money doing it, but we weren't convinced it was doing a bit of good. And it seemed to us at the time like, why are we spending all this money? Well, we have to. It's so long. Okay. It wasn't because of pollution. It was because we had to. But we didn't, and I agree with you, Tom, we couldn't discern the benefit. So it's not that I'm against this at all. It's just that I agree with you. There's such a delicate balance here.
Yeah. I mean, what's the division's perspective of this?
So, if I can, Dave Emmy, for the record, you know, we started looking at this program with this RFG issue kind of looming in 2017, and looked at it seriously from the standpoint of repealing the statute, and had gone to the point of drafting a bill draft request to do that. And we spent some time discussing it both internally and externally, and decided instead that what we would propose is a reset of the program rather than scrapping it altogether. That, yeah, it's difficult to really measure a benefit, an air quality benefit from this, but we felt like there are fleets that were invested in the program. It does kind of serve a purpose of sort of showing some public sector leadership with alternative fuels. And we felt like there was still some benefit to keeping the program if we could reform it and reset it. And we found, talking with some of the fleets, that they agreed with us that I think there are some who would gladly like to see it go away, but there are others who, you know, there's an investment there and they want to retain it, as well as some of the industries, like you heard, G Diesel, that are Nevada-based and have invested some bit into a product that's an alternative fuel. So that's kind of our perspective.
Well, Dave, follow up on that question, because a lot of these regs are done because EPA says, hey, you do it or we will. What's EPA's perspective on this?
Yeah, this really is a state program. It's a state
initiative. Just state?
Yeah. So it's okay. Not driven by the federal government.
Other comments?
Correct me if I'm wrong, though, but really the step change that resulted in this review is the reformulated gasoline step, right? That always was an option there. So now if that's there, it's like, well, everybody's going to be compliant because they have to use that. So that's what sort of triggered this review, right?
Yeah, Dave Emmy, yeah, that's right. That was the driver for kind of taking a hard look at the program and deciding, do we need to keep it or do we need to change it? We need to do something.
And is that a concrete for sure known that is going to be required next year when?
January 1st.
January 1st, 2017.
It's in the Federal Register already. It's,
Do you have any idea how much that's going to drive the price of gas up? I'm just curious. Well, no, because it doesn't make a difference, right?
Yeah.
It's just different. I'm just curious.
I think actually in the federal regulations they are required to assess that, and I think it's a few pennies.
They reported 2 to 3 cents a gallon at most in some areas.
Okay, just curious.
Just for the record, you know, I bought a hybrid in 2014, and within 6 months, price of gas dropped a dollar. So, if reformulated gas does increase the price, I'll feel much better.
Other comments, questions by the commission?
David Johnson, Clark County in Southern Nevada, if I may. Just to put some clarity on the program and what we look with down here, I pulled the data from 2014 to look at the number of vehicles registered in Clark County that would fall under this program versus the government fleets that are subjected to this program. All of the government vehicles in Clark County make up 0.0012% of the vehicles on the road in Clark County. And of course, with this program, we fully agree there should be a program in place to support and further alternative fuels in the state of Nevada for the government police to try to burn as clean as we can and to set the example. But there has to be some rationale to this. We believe what NDEP offered to us was a very viable offer compared to what we've been dealing with in the past, and especially with the RFG going away now. RFG in the past has cost on average 0.1099 cents a gallon more per what we pay locally for our regular fuel, plus top of that, because they will not send that fuel through the pipeline into Las Vegas. It must all be trucked in. Every single load you need must be trucked into the valley. They will not store RFG in Southern Nevada because we do not use enough of it to justify storage tanks being set aside to support our use of RFG. So we fully support NDEP. We've had many meetings with the gentleman up there, and we appreciate their time and coming down and visiting with the fleets in Southern Nevada. So we definitely support this plan. We think it's a very compromised plan that we can all agree with, and it's all attainable for us in Southern Nevada. And I think you will probably see any request for a variance go away once this plan is, if this plan is approved. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for putting that in perspective for us. You did a good job. Comments, questions?
Mr. Chairman, I'll make a motion to adopt regulatory petition R098-60.
I'll second that.
Moved and seconded to approve this petition. Before I go any further, I want to make sure there's nobody in the audience here that has any comments. And also, okay, we do have somebody here in the audience. Okay, come forward, please.
Norma Havens, USA Fleet Solutions, 5611 Britannia Drive, Reno, Nevada. And I'm just here if there are any other questions on the telematics side. I've been in the telematics business now 10 years. SIG has known me for probably 30 years because I helped the state bring the very first biodiesel station to the nation here in Nevada, and also ran a lot of the alternative fuel programs for my 24 years in the fuel industry. The thing on the telematics that a lot of people don't understand is that we qualify as a smog check in the state of Nevada and in the state of California and the state of Delaware, because we monitor all of the pollution controls on an engine, on the ECM. And so from that point of view, it goes beyond just, you know, regulating idle time and things like that, but we also track all of those emission things. We also provide a full smog report, and we also do a greenhouse gas emissions report. So there's a lot of things in the telematics that a lot of people are not aware of from a technology point of view. And as Commissioner Barbie had said, the price of the telematics has gone down dramatically, even from when the Department of Ag installed, and they're probably one of our first. They've been with us probably about 9 years. And so we do have quite a few governments, but they're not fully implemented. But I just wanted to make myself available if you had some questions on what telematics can do and its role at the table. It's a new technology, and that's what we wanted to say. There are technologies today that we didn't have 10 years ago. And I think there's going to be technologies, as you were saying, that we're going to see in 3 to 5 years we don't even have today. And so by adopting other opportunities for technology to help reduce emissions and to reduce the use of fuel, because one of the things we have found is that our fleets actually reduce the number of gallons they use because of a variety of things that we do within the fleet. And so by reducing fuel, that's a huge benefit from an air quality position. So those are some of the things that we bring to the table. I'm open for questions if there was any questions for
commissioners.
Just as a sidebar, it paid for itself in one day when we had a vehicle stolen and we were able to track it and make the arrest within 3 hours. So that alone was huge.
That's great. I have got more stories than you can even imagine on that kind of stuff. So we are in the process of fully, finally implementing with DMV. We're in the final throes of full implementation with DMV to be a fully qualified smog program. It was passed by the legislature 4 years ago, and we've been going through that whole process of putting that whole thing together internally. State of California just went like that and flipped the switch, and we're doing it right now in the state of California. BAR accepts us as a smog program.
And we just submit our paperwork to DMV for our smog check, and we're done.
Which is nice. Yes, it's the things that we do. It changed. The technology has changed. I can do a remote diagnostics on a vehicle in New York City, and tell you exactly if the check engine light is on, and what monitors are not ready, and what engine codes you might have. So I can see everything, and the fleet sees that, and so. We're looking at not allowing a vehicle to stay in poor emissions, but to change it immediately.
Would that mean that the market, I really agree with what you said about technology. So when technology goes to batteries, it puts you out of business?
No. In terms of batteries, there's still going to be a combustion diesel component, I think, in the world. And so do I see our industry going away? I don't see it going away. I see it more being modified, and I'm very heavy in the government fleet sector, and I have a lot of California fleets that are very heavy in the electric sector and the hybrid and the battery, and so they use us from a different perspective rather than from a smog emissions perspective. And stolen vehicles, I can't tell you how many stolen vehicles. Every vehicle in any of my fleets that has been stolen has been retrieved. So, those are little things. But we reduce speeding. Speeding costs money, by the way. You understand that. People don't understand how much speeding costs from a fuel perspective, let alone from a liability perspective. And so if you've got a vehicle that can test fuel consumption by speed, I highly recommend you do that, because I will tell you, my Subaru outside, I do much better when I stay under 65. I get up to 75 and I go down dramatically in my miles per gallon. So it's a fact of my speed does affect your pollution, let alone all the other things that we can do.
Just one more add-on. We actually did it for employee safety, because so many of our employees are in really remote areas of the state, and so if in some cases it may not go directly where, because it's attached to cell service, we see when they went off the map in terms of cell service and know where they last were, and we're able to, as a safety net.
And we now have a satellite process that for those who don't want to be off the net. Anytime we do that for certain fleets.
So, Tom, are you ready to buy one now?
I don't have any teenagers to apply this technology to.
So. I have done this on teenagers, yes.
Any other comments, questions? Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Okay, we do have a motion on the table, but I want to make sure there's no one else, either in Las Vegas or here, that wants to comment on this before the reconsider the motion? Hearing and seeing none, we have a motion on the floor. Any discussion of the motion and a second to approve this petition? Hearing none, all those signify in favor, aye.
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 Opposed? Hearing none, motion passes. And before I go any further, go ahead.
When soliciting comments from the public, I would recommend doing it prior to.
I know that. Yeah, Rich knows that. And we all, we do. It popped up. It is almost 10 after noon. Well, do the board want to go to lunch? We got two or three items, or do the board want to just go through it?
Just noting that I'll have to leave either way at 12:30 for another appointment, so I'm willing to power through.
Okay. Right, well, let's
wrap it up and go.
Okay. Let's go. Okay. Well, let's go on to item number 9, please. This is LCB file number R106-16.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and fellow commissioners. My name is Jonathan McCrane. I'm the supervisor for the underground storage tank and leak and underground storage tank program for the Nevada Division of Environmental Protection, Bureau of Corrective Actions. NDEP is proposing this regulatory petition in response to newly promulgated federal underground storage tank regulations, which were updated on July 15th, 2015. These proposed regulations will help prevent fuel releases from the roughly 1,300 facilities containing approximately 3,800 underground storage tanks in the state of Nevada. Implementation of these regulations will support early detection of fuel releases, which could ultimately lower the cost of soil and groundwater cleanup and reduce the number of gas stations seeking cost recovery from the state of Nevada Petroleum Fund. Nevada has been approved to administer and enforce the state-adopted underground storage tank regulations in lieu of a federal program since 1993. The state regulations will need to be updated to match the revised federal regulations to maintain this current program approval status. NDEP currently contracts out underground storage tank compliance inspections in Washoe and Clark County to the Washoe County Health District and Southern Nevada Health District, respectively. If this regulatory position is not adopted, then owner and operators of underground storage tanks in Nevada will most likely be faced with NDEP and federal EPA both providing regulatory oversight, which could lead to confusion for owners and operators as to inspection schedules and regulatory compliance issues. These proposed changes will amend the Nevada Administrative Code that regulates underground storage tanks in Nevada. This is accomplished by adopting by reference those provisions in the Code of Federal Regulations that cover underground storage tanks in the nation. The 2015 regulations changed certain portions of the original 1988 underground storage tank technical regulations that are in the Code of Federal Regulations 40 CFR Part 280. The changes establish federal requirements that are similar to the key portions of the previously adopted Energy Policy Act 2005. I'd like to refer to you to handout number 1, regulatory petition R106-16, Nevada, entitled Nevada Underground Storage Tank Release Prevention Regulatory History. In brief, in 1988, the original federal regulations were promulgated. In the mid-90s, the EPA determined that of the 1 million underground storage tanks in the nation, roughly 30% were leaking or had already leaked, of which half of those had contaminated local groundwater supplies. In 2005, the Energy Policy Act was enacted. This addressed certain secondary containment conditions for tanks and underground storage tank systems and operator training. And finally, in 2015, the federal EPA updated the federal regulations. Since July 15, 2015, state USD inspectors and our contracted counterparts in Washoe and Clark County have been discussing the new regulatory and compliance requirements that will be taking effect in October 2018 with gas station owners and operators. More recently, before the revised regulations were submitted to the Legislative Council Bureau for review, NDEP held and solicited comments through three stakeholder meetings held in Elko, Reno, and in Las Vegas on May 25th, 27th, and June 1st, respectively. Notices of the stakeholder meetings and invitations for comments were posted in all county public libraries, the NDEP buildings in Carson City and Las Vegas, and to the NDEP website. Comments were also invited via email to over 550 certified environmental managers who have been certified to manage soil and groundwater cleanups in the state, our certified underground tank handlers who install and repair the UST systems, and to our certified underground tank testers who perform compliance testing on those underground storage tank systems. About 51 individuals attended those stakeholder meetings. In general, comments during those stakeholder meetings focused on when the federal rules were going to go into effect and if and when inspectors were needed to be on site for testing of the containment systems, and also how wastewater that was generated during containment system checks should be handled and disposed of. Staff was able to answer those questions during the meetings on whether inspectors would need to be on site, which was no. And at the time, NDEP stated that there would need to be more research given and accomplished before we were able to answer the wastewater handling and disposal question. After LCB's review and approval of the newly proposed regulatory language, NDEP held two public workshops, one on August 8th and the other on September 12th at the Nevada Legislative Building with video conferencing to the Grant Sawyer Building in Las Vegas. At the time, about 15 individuals attended those workshops. Comments from those workshops centered on an alternative test method for containment sump systems and also if the wastewater from those tests would be classified as a hazardous waste or not. Written answers were provided to the commenters, and those answers were also posted to the NDEP website. Those two answers being that it is the Bureau's position that an alternative test method could be proposed and go through a statutory and regulatory look-through the Bureau, and that wastewater for those tests at this time is not considered a hazardous waste because it can comply with an exemption through the RCRA regs. No opposition to the regulations or responses to specific questions had been received to date. There will be no state added economic impacts to small businesses. The rules that were codified on July 15, 2015 are federal requirements that the regulated business and industry must comply with regardless of whether the state or the US EPA or NDEP implements them. In fact, industry prefers that the NDEP implement the federal rules since NDEP already has an active working relationship with industry and will implement the federal regulations in an effective and efficient manner as possible. This time I'd like to refer to you to handout number 2, Benefit for Owner Operators and the State of Nevada. This provides some information on the long-term financial benefits to owners and operators for gas stations and to the State of Nevada.
I think I'm going to take this piece real quick, kind of walk you down through the benefits to owner-operators and the state of Nevada as we see it right now. Mr. Chairman and members of the commission, my name is Jeff Collins. I'm the chief of the Corrective Actions Bureau. We thought it was important to kind of give you some perspective on what the costs are associated with the business we're in and the business we regulate. I think there's definitely a benefit to the owners and operators of gas stations and to the state of Nevada. If you look through this real quick, I'll point out bullets 1 and 2. First of all, we wanted to give you a sense of how many releases we've had since the inception, actually releases that have become cases since the inception of the State Petroleum Fund. Petroleum Fund began in 1989, and as you can see, about just over 1,300 cases have become reimbursed through that time. We have good statistics from 2010 to 2016, about a 7-year span. It gives us an understanding about what we spend for these cleanup cases per year, on the order of about $8.3 million is spent to support cleanups across the state. About 30% of those cleanups are groundwater cases. We feel that
if these regulations are implemented, we could eliminate the lion's share of that 30%, because what these regulations will create is a better compliance schedule, more inspections of these gas stations, and if a release is occurring, hopefully it'll be caught sooner. So maybe it ends up being a soil impact and not a groundwater impact, which is, as you can see, the more expensive cleanup. Soil cleanups are on the order of about $200,000 on average. Groundwater cleanups are about $650,000. Now that's an average over time. To give you some perspective, right now at Zephyr Cove, we have a case that's approaching, may approach the $4 million mark on cleanup. The other thing I'd like to point out is 10% of those costs are borne on the owner-operator. So for a $4 million cleanup, $400,000 is borne on the owner-operator. That's a big chunk of change. We feel like these regulations can prevent that size of a release and that size of a cleanup. So just to wrap up here, it's important also to understand that there may be a cost to gas station owners to implement these regulations. That's not lost on us. We actually did some outreach to industry to understand, okay, if these gas stations need to upgrade their systems, their tank systems. And keep in mind, there are all different generations of underground storage tank systems out there. 30-year-old systems, brand new systems. Some are in very good compliance, some are probably a bit out of compliance, especially when it comes to these new regulations. So we took an honest look at what's it going to cost somebody that may be out of compliance that's in a rural area, and we came up with about $50,000 to $80,000 to come into compliance. Now that's a cost to come into compliance, that's a cost of doing business, but I think what we need to keep in mind is that's also a cost that will hopefully prevent a release on the order of, you know, a $650,000 cleanup or larger, that property owner, that owner-operator would have to pay 10% of. So if it's a $650,000 release or cleanup, or up to $1 million, they're going to be on the hook for $65,000 to $100,000. We feel like if these regulations are adopted, we could save on order of $20,000 to $65,000 per release for the owner-operators. And I think if we can avoid the groundwater cases in the future, which is about 30% of the costs annually, we could save the state close to $2.5 million in petroleum fund reimbursement fees. So that's quite a bit there on what we think the benefits are for these regulations and coming into compliance with them, making sure there's more inspections. But with that, I don't know if you want to wrap up or do you have any questions on that specifically?
Well, I'll look. Commissioner, are any questions, comments, staff?
Just a question. Where does the money from the that supplies to the petroleum fund come from?
There's a, Jeff Collins for the record, there's a tax on fuel. Fuel that comes into the state, fuel that's refined in the state, and it's a quarter of a cent per gallon. So that tax has been in effect since 2010, continually. Before that, they kind of stopped and started that. And then also, there's an enrollment fee for each of these owner-operators, and that's $100 per tank. So if they have three tanks, they pay $300, but consider the insurance policy they just got. They get $1 million worth of coverage per tank for $100. I don't think they can get, I don't know if anybody else can get that kind of coverage. So it's kind of a no-brainer for them to adopt the petroleum fund coverage, or should they enroll into the petroleum fund, and then if they have a release, seek reimbursement through the fund.
Thanks.
I'm kind of surprised. I understand, I almost feel like this is a rock in a hard place. I mean, like we have to do it, or EPA will do it for us. I wonder about that, okay? But And I did attend one of your workshops. And when I look at this, I don't know why, I just have this impression. There's a cost to these gas stations or some of the small businesses, and that cost could be significant. And yet you didn't really get a lot of pushback from me, or did they understand that?
Jonathan McRae, for the record. Kind of to point back to the regulatory look, since 2005, when the Energy Policy Act came into effect, and we adopted those into the regulations in 2008, a lot of the requirements that are being placed upon owners and operators, they've had to comply with since 2008. The cost that is going to be seen now is, since 2008, with all new construction, every sump had to be at least hydrostatically tested at the time of construction. The federal rule now says that that will need to be accomplished every 3 years. So that's going to be an added cost, one for the test, but two, if the sump fails, it will need to be repaired. Now, a sump at your gas station is anywhere between 4 to 6 feet in diameter and goes down 6 feet. So that's a good amount of concrete that's going to have to be broken, and good amount of time and effort to repair that. We have had already some facilities between last July and now have to go through that process because they've actually had a release, either a fuel line failed or some sort of leak detection or leak happened in those sumps, and they've actually had to see those tests and those repairs realized. The added benefit is that since it happened after July of 2015, their 3-year clock started. So they, once, if the rules go into effect as proposed in 2018, they've already had their 3-year test, so they wouldn't have to test again until, say, 2017, or 2019, or 2020, with how we're proposing that these rules go into effect. So, but yes, Mr. Chairman, we do recognize that there is going to be a cost to the owners and operators of this state to come into compliance with this rule. That was also the reason why we're coming to you so early in the regulatory adoption process. These regs just came out from the feds in 2015. They've been bouncing through the federal system since 2011. We think and feel that if we are early adopters coming to you to get our regs pushed through and updated, that we're going to be giving the regulated community at least 2 years to start coming into compliance with these rules before the Fed time of October 2018.
So you think these operators, because I didn't see a lot of pushback at the public hearing that I went to, a workshop, excuse me, it's inevitable. I mean, they're going to have to do it one way or the other, and therefore, even though we're doing this, we're not putting something on them extra or another burden of cost that they're going to have to do anyway.
Jonathan McRae, for the record, yes, that's correct.
I was surprised.
We were as well, sir.
Was there industry group representative? I don't know, is it Western States Petroleum Board? Was there a group or a member from there?
Petroleum Marketers Convenience Store Association, yeah. Peter Kruger was in attendance at those.
Okay.
Tom. And, we have met with Mr. Kruger separately to, kind of reach out to him and his industry to make sure they understand. So we're trying to hit this from a lot of different, areas. We're trying to reach out to the certified environmental managers that we deal with every day that clean up these sites. We tried to reach out to the owner operators through a separate listserv, through the association. There's a lot of different avenues we can use, but I feel like we've been talking about this since July of 2015. We have regular inspection schedules that we provide to the state. Washoe County does, and Southern Nevada Health District does as well. So there's a lot of outreach just on the ground and at these gas stations. Whether they understand the true ramifications for each one of their gas stations, I don't think they necessarily do because of all the different generations of gas stations. They might not realize that it's going to cost, maybe it'll cost $10,000. It'll be a fairly easy repair. The ones that are way out of compliance may reach that $80,000 mark, and that may be the gas station in Jarbidge, someplace in the middle of nowhere, pretty much.
Which could put them out of business.
Well, that's another consideration. that we took into account.
Well, I'm not blaming anybody. I'm just trying to make sure I understand whether or not, as an observer at that workshop, I sit there and I go, these guys get this? Dave, do you have a comment?
Dave Emmy, for the record. One thing I wanted to mention is that, you know, one thing we did hear from industry, Peter Kruger in particular, was the concern that just what you said, that there may be kind of the last chance Texaco that goes out of business in Nevada and may not be able to get gas in someplace like Denio. And so we've been working with them over the last few months on a bill draft request that the industry intends to bring, because it was past our deadline to submit something that would provide a financial assistance program that would be need-based, and it would use the existing petroleum fund. It wouldn't be an additional fee or source of revenue, but it would allow us to use a certain amount of the petroleum fund to provide financial assistance where there is a demonstrated financial need. And that's kind of what we have in mind, is really the kind of station where if it's not there, you're not going to get gas.
Makes sense. Makes sense. Commissioners, any other comments, questions?
I just have a question. What is the status of the fund? How much money is in it?
It's very solvent. In fact, the program coordinator is sitting off to my left here. Val King actually happens to be the program coordinator.
I can say a little bit, and Val can jump in because she's really the expert. But the gas tax generates about $12 million a year. And we've been reimbursing petroleum claims somewhere around $8 to $9 million a year. And there's a provision in the statute right now that anything above $7.5 million at the end of the year goes to the highway fund. So the idea, say, with this financial assistance program would be, you know, well, we're allowed to spend more money. What we don't spend goes to the highway fund at the end of the year. That's above $7.5 million.
Has that fund and the request for reimbursement from leaking tanks, you said, was $8 million approximately a year? Has that been steady or gradually going down with increased removal and replacement of newer technology and tanks?
Val King, for the record. It's remained fairly steady over the last 6 years, 6 to 7 years. It'll bounce up from 7 to 9 and back down to 8.
I'll say, Dave Emmy again, that, you know, we really are taking a hard look at Jeff and John Val as well at some of these petroleum fund cases that have been ongoing for a number of years and trying to bring cases to closure. So that's kind of an initiative that we might to look at that issue.
Good comment.
Jonathan McCray, for the record. I was just going to say the With the fleet, if you want to call it, and maybe the fleet's not the right word, but with the known universe of underground storage tanks in the state, you know, approaching 30-year life expectancies, that's what most owner operators were told. You know, 1988, if you dropped your first tank, we're approaching that 30-year mark. Most of our cases are coming in, and most of those tanks are at least pre-1994 install. So. We're very consistent with that kind of, you know, $8 to $9 million, you know, 9 to 10 extra cases coming in, cases going out. So very steady, just because of the known universe we have out there.
Is it your opinion that given this, these changes, and the money you do have available, that, and what Dave is saying, which I think is commendable, can we keep up with it? Can we help out? Can it be done? I mean, we know there's aging infrastructure all over the United States. It's just another example. Is that something we can handle?
It's our Bureau's opinion that, yes, we could affect some positive change with some of these locations that may have issues.
I'm just curious about the numbers, Jeff or John. So 1,342 cases over 27 years, about 50 a year. And given what you just said, John, about the life expectancy of it,
I would imagine if you were looking at a graph, we're starting to see more of those cases because those tanks are wearing out. Is that true? And then the second question is, what is the universe of underground storage tanks? How many are we talking?
So in the first question is, yes, I do believe we're starting to see a positive, unfortunately, a positive trend in tank failures. You know, we have several things happening. You have the first generation of fiberglass tanks that are having a really hard time with, had a really hard time with ethanol. Caused some brand new tanks in Arizona and other places to fail completely because of the new fuel. We're also pushing into that range where, you know, the economy was doing very well in the mid to late 90s. And with that, a lot of gas stations got put in, you know, cities were seeing great growth. Convenience stores, gas stations were being built, and obviously we saw a downturn of those. And I believe we're seeing an uptick with new construction in both, you know, Washoe and Clark County and also in the rural counties. And I do apologize. Can I have the second question again?
Just the number of underground storage tanks, you think? General numbers, is it 10,000?
Well, we've as of right now, we have 3,800 regulated underground storage tanks. I believe at least 60% of those are between 1994 and 2005 construction days.
Thank you.
Jason, if I can add on to that, I think what you're also going to see is, if you think about this, there's going to be this kind of compliance push, and people are going to be really taking a hard look at their tank systems, and they're going to uncover some things that either they don't know about, maybe hopefully there's small releases that they can clean up quickly. But I think what we're going to see is we're going to see a lot of these gas stations come into compliance, but while they're doing that, they're going to find some releases, and they're going to call us, they're going to call the petroleum fund and say, you know, I'm enrolled, I need coverage to clean up this release. So we're going to see, I think, an increase in costs to clean up a lot of these stations that are going to have to take a hard look at, you know, how they're operating. And then, but I think based on that compliance and those upgrades, we're going to see everything kind of drop off at a point. So there's going to be, you know, some stations out of compliance for a while, and we can use regulatory discretion to kind of help these people along, shepherd them through the process, make sure that, you know, we get them whole again. Then I think over time we're going to see a lot of these stations, because of the inspections they're doing, because of the upgrades, not have the amount of releases we're seeing right now. Even the older stations are going to be into compliance, and they're not going to have as many releases. So we're going to see the whole, you know, we're going to see this uptick, and we're going to see this level out. That's our hope.
And I think that's where I was trying to go.
Yeah.
With what Dave has said and what Val and you have saying about, can we handle that upsurge before it peaks off?
We can. I think we can with the petroleum fund.
Okay.
And I think we can with the inspections that we're doing.
One last question. Have you run this by the petroleum board?
This regulation?
Yeah, in regard to potential financial assistance as well. From
I serve on the petroleum board. You know, the board to review the claims that are filed against the petroleum. And the, you know, John gave a presentation about the regulations, and we have discussed the financial assistance concept as well.
Any more comments, questions? Anybody in the Las Vegas audience that has any comments or questions they want to have on the record? Okay, how about the Crescent City audience? Okay, hearing none from either source. With the board's pleasure on this item, please.
Mr. Chairman, I move adoption of regulatory petition R106-16.
Second.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded to adopt this regulatory petition. Are there any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by aye.
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 Opposed? None? Motion passes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and fellow commissioners. Thank you.
Item number 10. You going to stay with us, Jeff?
I'm stay put. chair's getting comfortable now.
Good afternoon, Chairman and Commissioners. I'm Rebecca Bodner, and I supervise the certification program for the Bureau of Corrective Actions. You've already met our Bureau Chief, Jeff Collins. I'm proposing to amend state regulation certification of certain consultants and contractors, NAC 459-970 to 459-9729, LCB file R123-16, and I hopefully am your last regulatory change of the day. The purpose of the certification program is to ensure consultants and contractors possess the proper education, experience, and training to provide their services for a fee in Nevada. Currently, the certification program certifies environmental managers for hazardous waste handling and environmental cleanup, underground storage tank handlers to install and repair underground storage tanks, and underground storage tank testers to perform compliance testing on underground storage tank systems. We are proposing to amend the state regulation in four ways. One, I'd wish to remove certification of a person certified by another state or recognized organization, reciprocity. Remove certification of a specialist in the management of hazardous waste. Add certification of a provider of an approved underground storage tank training program. And the fourth is to add a renewal time limit of 1 year for certifications that have expired. First off, we'd like to remove reciprocity because all of our certifications require knowledge of specific Nevada requirements to be eligible to conduct work in Nevada. Accepting reciprocity of an individual certified by another state or recognized organization circumvents the specificity of Nevada's eligibility requirements. Therefore, we are requesting to remove reciprocity from the regulations. Second, we'd like to remove the certification for specialists in the management of hazardous waste because the certification is duplicative and obsolete. Persons handling hazardous waste for the purpose of reporting to our Bureau are required to be environmental managers. To date, there are over 500 environmental managers certified. Since 2002, only four individuals have applied to be specialists in the management of hazardous waste, with no renewal since 2007. Therefore, we're requesting for this designation to be removed. Third is to add certification for providers of an approved underground storage tank program, training program. There is a federal regulation requirement for states to identify and approve operator training programs for underground storage tank operators at gas stations throughout the state. We are proposing to provide oversight through certification of the persons implementing the training programs, which will standardize and ensure each program meets the federal regulation requirements. This change will reference 40 Code of Federal Regulations 280 for specific program training criteria. The training criteria includes like tank operation and maintenance, spill and overflow prevention, release detection and related reporting, corrosion protection, emergency response, and environmental and regulatory consequences of releases. As the certifications currently certify similar persons providing services to the gas station industry, adding the certification allows for consistency. The certification program will maintain a list of training program providers on the certification public website, as it does for the other three professional aforementioned certifications, for the regulated community to refer to. Certification requires an application to show that the eligibility requirements have been met, $100 application fee and $100 two-year renewal fee. We feel this is a nominal fee to provide this type of service in Nevada and is consistent with all the other certifications. Lastly, we are proposing to add a certification renewal time limit of 1 year from the date of expiration. Currently, there is no renewal date grace period in regulation, so certified individuals can renew their certifications after expiration date instead of having to submit a new application. Clarification of certification renewal requirements not more than 1 year after the certificate date of expiration will help staff to implement a renewal date grace period. After this date, the certificate holder will be required to reapply for their certification, which in one case will require them to retest. We solicited comment from the constituents on our current list of over 550 certified individuals and 200 underground storage tank owner operators and received no comments or concerns. In conjunction with the underground storage tank compliance program, which you just heard, we conducted stakeholder meetings in Las Vegas, Reno, and Elko and received no comments or concerns. We also conducted public meetings in Reno with video conferencing in Las Vegas and again received no comments or concerns regarding the regulatory changes. That concludes my presentation. Are there any questions?
Question regarding reciprocity for CEMs. Can you give me a specific example of like the difference in Nevada requirement that you mentioned, the reason you're not going to grant reciprocity or doing away with it, like another state might have a requirement that Nevada has? Can you give me an example or two of that?
I'll try to answer that, Tom. Jeff Collins, for the record. What we've done in Nevada, and I don't know if you remember back when Alan Biaggi thought this up, but this was an attempt to protect consumer protection, or this was an implemented for consumer protection. And what we wanted to do is make sure that consultants working for a fee or consulting for a fee in Nevada knew specifically what our requirements were, what our regs were, what our geology and hydrogeology was. It's different than California. It's basin and range geology and hydrogeology. It's different from Reno than it is in Las Vegas. We didn't feel like somebody coming from Wisconsin could understand those nuances. So we have a 200 question test that we've developed that's very specific to Nevada. We feel like somebody coming from California should have to pass that test and understand our regulations and our requirements and the way we do business in Nevada before they can practice as an environmental consultant here. I think it's very important that we kind of get that nod of agreement from them. We sit down, we talk to them, we have them come in for the test. They can take it twice a year. And we talk to them about, hey, look, we're all in this together. Let's take our hats off when we're trying to deal with these cleanup issues from leaking underground storage tanks. We're trying to come up with a common goal. We're trying to keep the cost down. It's not a moneymaker necessarily. The petroleum fund's not there to, you know, support your business. It's there to support a cleanup quickly and efficiently. And we want those people to know that. And I don't know if somebody just coming in saying, I did this in New Jersey for 20 years and I should be able to do this in Nevada, sits very well with us. So I think to answer your question, there are differences, and it's not to say that, you know, the professional geologist testing in California is a tougher test. It probably is a tougher test, but it's not Nevada specific, and we just don't feel like that person can translate that information into Nevada specific information. Long-winded, but that's kind of where we're at.
Okay. Yeah, Mr. Chairman, kind of along those same lines, and I support what you've just proposed. I was just curious how other states deal with Nevada's CEMs. Are we getting, are CEMs getting reciprocity in other states, or have they already moved to something that you're proposing where, again, it's state-specific, site-specific, and you need to pass a test?
This is
anew.
It's a good question. Jeff Collins, for the record. I don't think any other state really has a program like this, to tell you the truth. I mean, they have professional geologist programs. They have professional engineer programs, obviously. But I'm not aware, and I haven't talked to any CEMs that have used our certification to get reciprocity in another state. I don't know, Rebecca, if you've heard.
Yeah,
or
I can
add
that.
Have you?
Ben Wilkinson, Director, Bureau of Corrective Actions, I'm the certification coordinator. This is kind of unique to Nevada, and other states have.
Pardon me for interrupting, would you mind stepping up to the
podium
so we can get this on the minutes?
Other states utilize, as Jeff has previously stated.
Sure.
Yeah. My name is Ben Wilkinson. I work for the Bureau of Corrective Actions. I'm the certification coordinator. Most states utilize environmental professionals. There's registered environmental professionals. There's a kind of a whole litany of different certifications that we have, and they call to see if they can use those here in lieu of our Nevada certification program. And here we have unique regulations with the petroleum fund and other things, in addition to what Jeff had already outlined, that we feel, you know, require this extra step. So we have people that call that have professional engineering certifications, environmental professionals, and as far as I know, there's nothing that's exactly like this. There's parts of it that are similar, especially from environmental professional certification. So as far as we know, this is the only state that has this particular setup,
and I don't believe that it's used in any other state.
So you don't get, Ben, you don't get calls from people saying from another state. So maybe
there might be one right now.
So maybe Nebraska calls and says, hey, I've got this guy that is a CEM in Nevada. You know, what are the requirements? What does this entail? I never received a call like that when I was doing Rebecca's job. But I don't know if you've received any recently to ask about the CEM requirements.
Ben Wilkinson again for the record. No, I haven't received any calls like that because they really only have to sign off on work that's being submitted to the state here. So I don't really see how that would work somewhere else because they utilize other certifications in lieu of our CEM program. So it doesn't really hold the same value elsewhere unless they took the time to sort of look at it as a state-specific requirement. Then if they did that, they probably wouldn't take ours because they would want their state's specific geology,
right,
hydrogeology, and everything else included. So it's really unique to us.
Thank you.
I do have one. The training programs for operators for underground storage tanks, who actually teaches those?
Rebecca Bodner, for the record. There are several online programs, as well as there's a gentleman in Nevada that has a program for those programs.
And that's how they get certified, huh?
Yeah, they can go through that and get certified. There's currently, we had a list of about 18 different operators that we would give if people called and asked for it. We just weren't really overseeing those very tightly to see it, make sure that they were all the same or, you know, there's some standard according to federal regulation. So that's what this program would do.
Okay. Keep in mind, having a list of trainers is a requirement of the last regulations that you just listened to, that petition with UST or underground storage tank compliance. It's a requirement that the state has a list of trainers for these programs that can go out to the gas stations and train those individuals to operate their gas stations safely. I think the largest group, I think, in the state is probably that Petroleum Marketers and Convenience Store Association. Peter Kruger heads up. They have a number of trainers that will be on our list, and they'll most likely have an approved program for that.
So a guy that's running a gas station has to have a trainee, and under the regs that we just approved earlier, once every 3 years or something, has to do a pressure test, or do you bring somebody else in for that?
You bring a separate person in for that. There's another certification within the program, which is a certified tank tester.
Okay.
So this training we're talking about is more of operating the gas station, day-to-day operation. You know, what's it take? And there's different classes of operators, basically. But a Class C operator is the guy that's probably behind the counter that can look at, you know, the equipment, make sure that if an alarm's going off, they can make a call. So probably kind of the lowest amount of training for that person. And there's B and A operators.
And they have to document and put that, their inspections daily, weekly, whatever.
Absolutely.
And that's what you guys inspect then.
Yeah. That's okay. That compliance inspection we were talking about during the last.
And to Mr. Thanks. Sonny, you know, you got these training programs, either with an instructor or online. Be consistent, or they still take a test?
They won't have to take a test, but they'll have to show that they meet the eligibility requirements that are built into those federal regulations. So we're going to adopt those federal regulations. I think it's built in. I think Rebecca's
40 CFR 280 has specific criteria that each of the training programs has to have. So they would submit their program to us. They did that originally when we had the original list. They submitted programs to us, these booklets, so this is what we train. You know, they're actual training documents. And we would make sure that they match up with federal regulation.
I thought I heard earlier that there was a 200-question test.
That's for environmental managers. For the CEMs, yeah. Okay. So for CEMs, we administer that test in-house twice a year. For underground tank testers and tank handlers, they actually have to have certification too and go through class. We accept other training programs for that, and they have to just show documentation that they took that test. So it's different for each program, what we accept.
Thank you. And this is Ben Wilkinson again for the record. This would be along the lines of what we call the UTT, which is underground tank tester, UTH, underground tank handler. The certification for training programs would be similar to those, or they don't have to have an examination. They would be producing proof that they're following in compliance with the federal regulations, and then we have to maintain our list of people that are active that are, you know, taking the time to do this.
Anyone else? Okay, the Las Vegas audience, anybody there want to comment or ask questions of this petition? Okay, how about the Carson City office? Okay, I'm hearing none from either location. Back to the commission. What's commission's pleasure, please?
I'd move to approve regulatory petition R123-16 as submitted.
I'll second.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded to approve and adopt this regulatory petition. Any questions, discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? None. Motion passes.
Thank you.
So our last item, if I remember correctly, is Dave. It's the Dave Show.
Okay. Dave Emmy for the record. Try to be brief. As far as management changes within NDEP, there was one I wanted to bring up. Paul Comba was promoted to Bureau Chief in our Bureau of Water Quality Planning recently with the retirement of Kathy Sertic. Paul's been working in the mining reclamation program as a supervisor for a number of years, and prior to that actually worked in water quality planning for about 10 years. So he's got a good background, and excited to have him on board. That's really it at a management level. Things seem to be kind of tapering off as far as turnover within the agency. It's sort of stabilizing, so that's been good. Other stuff, I think I'll just mention the Volkswagen settlement because it's kind of interesting. If you've read about this at all, you know, Volkswagen was called to task for having defeat devices, which, as I understand it, was really software installed on a range of diesel vehicles from 2009 to 2015. That was found, and there have been a number of actions, class action lawsuits, and EPA and the state of California filed suit against Volkswagen and came to a settlement recently that was pretty significant. It was about almost $15 billion, most of which had to do with kind of the consumer side of things, recall and replacement of vehicles or repair of the vehicles and things like that. But from the state standpoint, it also established what they call a mitigation trust fund, or requires Volkswagen to fund a mitigation trust in the amount of $2.7 billion. And there's a formula as part of the settlement that allocates that money to the states and a portion to tribes. And I'm assuming it's based on vehicles or population or some sort of thing. So the allocation for Nevada would be $22 million, which, you know, it's not a small amount. And really what it's for is the same kind of stuff that we've been doing for years in what we call our Diesel Emission Reduction Act program, or DERA program, where we've been getting grant funds from EPA, and we've used them to do things like fund replacement of school buses with newer, cleaner technology, or retrofits like engine heaters in school buses. And in Clark County, where they tend to have a new kind of school bus fleet, there wasn't that opportunity, but we did things like fund street sweeper replacements. So the idea is to replace engines, diesel engines, with cleaner ones, basically, or replace wholesale vehicles with cleaner technology, and to reduce NOx emissions. So that's what the $22 million would be use for. It's not a settled deal yet. The parties have settled. The consent decree is consent agreement is before the court. EPA's filed a motion to accept it, and the court has to act on that. And then once they do, there's a trustee that has to be named nationally to administer this $2.7 billion. And then the state has to go through a process to be named as a beneficiary. But anyway, I bring that up because it's fairly significant. Most of the, we would anticipate administering that, the NDP would be the lead agency in administering that funding. And we probably, my intention was to work with our state I&M committee, that's the SMOC check committee that includes Clark and Washoe County and DMV, to kind of provide advice in coming up with projects that would be funded with this money. We actually have to come up with a plan and then later on specific projects to fund. So it's kind of something that's in the works. Just thought I'd bring that to your attention. I don't know. I think I'll leave it to you. If you have questions about other things we're doing at NDEP, I'd be glad to try to answer them.
Maybe you can comment on Leo. That's part of management.
Yeah, sure. Leo Drostoff, our department director for DCNR, retired not too long ago. Kay Shearer was his deputy and was named interim director. There's a recruitment out for, an open recruitment out for applications for a new director, so we'll just have to wait and see. How that happens, and but we're continuing to do our jobs.
Does this mean that you're leaderless?
No. No, I have a lot of, I've worked pretty closely with Kay, and I really enjoy working with her, so.
I understand she's a very confident individual. That's, I mean, I've heard that.
She is.
And I'm down in Vegas.
Yeah, she is. She's very good, and we feel very comfortable. And Jason is in the department, and so we're very happy to have her on an interim basis, and who knows, maybe longer.
Yeah, follow up to the Superfund listing for Urington, any movement there? Were we put on the list, the money flowing in?
We did talk about the Anaconda site last time, so what happened there is, there was a funding gap issue, so of about $30 million or so for the orphan share at the Anaconda site near Urington. And we have tried to come up with private sources of funding. We weren't able to do that back in March, so the governor sent a letter conditionally concurring with listing of the site on the Superfund National Priority List, or NPL. The site has been proposed for listing. I think it was published in the Federal Register in September. And the schedule is to have a final listing sometime in March. Listing the site on the NPL just means that there's access to federal funds to pay for the orphan share. I'll say parallel to that, in recent months, we have been in discussions with Atlantic Richfield Company / BP, and they are interested in negotiating something where they may be willing to pay that orphan share in exchange for the state taking the lead over the site. That's not a decision we can make unilaterally. It would require the concurrence with an agreement with EPA. So how that plays out remains to be seen, but that's going parallel with the listing process.
So if the ball is in play with EPA on listing and this Atlantic ARCO thing works out, how does that set with EPA?
So,
can any stop the things in motion?
So EPA has a process and actually printed guidance on deferral of NPL listing. And it was set up in the 90s, and it was really geared toward sites. Back then, there were a lot of Superfund sites that were kind of log-jammed and not moving through the process. And they recognized that there were some sites where You have a cooperative, responsible party. The community's on board. The state can take the lead and get things moving and not wait for Superfund. So they wrote up some guidance on how to defer sites from NPL listing. So that's kind of a process we would have to follow. And again, it would require an agreement with EPA to defer listing.
Other commission questions? You know, you got him where you want him right now.
I was curious if we should be anticipating the ozone regulation for our next meeting in November, and if there have been any modifications or developments for that?
No, we won't have, we probably won't have the adoption of that 2015 standard until probably next fall, I think we're anticipating. But the update on that is that we were obligated to make designations to proposed designations to EPA as to which areas of the state we think, based on the, I think it's 2013 to 2015 monitoring data, would be in attainment of standard, and which areas of the state would be in non-attainment. So we submitted that package to EPA October 1st by the deadline. And what we came out with was, based on the data, was only areas, hydrographic basins in Clark County were proposed to be in non-attainment with the standard. All other areas of the state were either in attainment or not classifiable because there's no monitoring data. So that's kind of where we're at. Now, what will happen next is EPA will then come out with final area designations a year from now, in October of 2017, and it will be based on 1 year's newer data, through 2016 monitoring data. So there may be some change. Washoe County was kind of on the cusp, but they were able to, they're at least arguing that they're in attainment by removing some exceptional event data due to wildfires and things like that.
Thank you. Any bill draft requests that you've seen give you pause or concern?
You know, to be honest, I haven't spent a lot of time reviewing BDRs. It's just so hard to, you know, they get published as a kind of cryptic, a partial sentence as to what it means, you know. Reforms related to water, who knows, right? Mm-hmm. You know, Jason's got a dozen of them. You know, I don't know. I really don't know. As far as the agency, we only submitted one agency bill draft request, and it's really just some cleanup language in the drinking water program related to authority to set fees. So nothing really substantive.
That was my question, is do you have any BDRs?
Yeah, just one just from the agency.
Okay.
Yeah.
I would just like to share that I've had an opportunity with several companies to have a pulse on some of the permitting processes and involvement in economic development community. And I think the process of working John Hanzo and at UNR has really been beneficial to all size of companies. Mm-hmm. To really help shepherd people through. And now that they are going in more with their eyes open and understanding the process, there seems to be a lot less frustration. And in particular, there was a company that's a lead battery recycler that has some
aqua metals.
Yes, has some complications to that process.
It's not as well, so.
Yep, it was. Yeah. So it afforded me an opportunity to sit in on some of the public workshops, and just wanted to relay some kudos to your team. The presentations, the way in which it was conducted, the overall process was very positive, very professional, and starting to now get positive feedback from the economic development community rather than all that negativity that we were seeing.
Yeah, thanks for that. You know, and one thing I want to mention was, you know, we spend a few hours on these regulatory petitions, but I think you heard today that we spend about, those that are significant, particularly that air permitting petition, which was really my initiative. I spent about 2 years on that. So there's a lot of work that goes into that. But really what we're trying to do is run a better business, streamline process, get our staff to focus on the things that are important and the things that really impact the environment, and also provide better service to industries, particularly new companies coming into the state. So it's really something that we spend a lot of time working on, and I appreciate the support of the commission with those, especially three of those petitions that were really kind of changing the landscape with the regulations.
You're making good progress.
Thanks.
Your staff did an excellent job on the presentations today, too, and answering our questions as well.
Yeah, I think that's what I was trying to say earlier to the beginning of the meeting. This is not a better stamp up here, but you can see there's a lot of discussion and questions so that we understand what's going on. And your staff is responding to that very well. So that it makes a really good symbiotic performance and operation here, so we appreciate that.
Yeah, help to keep us honest.
David, I think you're off the hook. Oh, you did that
okay.
Well.
Thanks.
Okay, that brings us to item number 12, which again is public comment at the end of the meeting. Remember that we can't take any action on a matter that's not been properly agendized for action. So is there anybody in Las Vegas that has any final comments for us at this public comment section? Okay, here in Carson City, is there anyone that would like to speak? Seeing none, that concludes our meeting. Val, when is our next meeting?
The next meeting is next month on November
16th. Okay. Are we going to meet here?
We will be meeting here.
Okay, great. Okay. Thank you all. Thank you for coming. Sure.